Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
There was a, I don't know if you reported or not, but there was some sort of shootout on the interstate in Massachusetts. Within the last 24 hours, I was curious about who the law enforcement was in a shootout with, and it ended up being a group of non-white black males. Of some sort of organization. The last part of the name was Moores, but I don't know the full name of it. I think most of them were arrested. I could be wrong. I didn't really follow it real hard, but I find it interesting. I'll do some more research.
Members of the so-called Rise of the Moores group faced a judge today, including two men from Rhode Island.
The militia group was involved in an hours-long armed standoff with Massachusetts State Police on 95 North this weekend. They're now facing several gun charges after a state trooper found them on the side of the road with rifles and pistols wearing military-style gear.
12 News reporter Brittany Schaefer joins us now live from outside of court in Medford, Massachusetts, with how members of the group explain their actions today. Brittany?
Well, Mike, Kim, the hearings are still going on due to many delays from disruptions and objections. The two men from Rhode Island, one from Providence, one from Pawtucket, both faced a judge this afternoon. The Rise of the Moores say they don't follow federal or state laws. That logic also continuing in the courtroom Tuesday.
Hold on, I have some more questions. You're going to get a full opportunity to speak. I just have a few more questions, okay?
Two of the 11 men arrested are from Rhode Island. The first arraigned Quinn Cumberlander of Pawtucket, the 40-year-old describing his group as a well-regulated militia. Police say 29-year-old Jamal Latimer of Providence is the group's leader. The 29-year-old saying he does not agree with the several gun charges brought against him.
I understand that you are charged with a number of crimes. Is that true?
That is not true.
Other members of the Rise of the Moores and family were present in court today. One member, only wishing to be identified as Rashad, says he is there to support his fellow comrades, also telling us more about the group's mission.
We're a civic organization. We teach about nationality, we teach about law, and we teach about history.
And Cumberlander and Latimer were both held without bail and are both due back in court on Friday for a dangerousness hearing. For now, live in Medford, I'm Brittany Schaefer, 12 News.
Arraignments have been going on all day for the 11 members of a Rhode Island-based group involved in a long standoff that shut down Route 95. Members of the self-identified militia claim they do not recognize state or federal laws, a point several of them brought up in court today. 12 News reporter Brittany Schaefer joins us now from Medford, Massachusetts, with an update.
Massachusetts state troopers surround both the inside and outside of the courthouse here today. According to police, two of the men arrested are from Rhode Island, one from Pawtucket, the other from Providence. Both faced a judge today, this afternoon.
You understand
objections.
Frequent disruptions, outbursts, and objections.
How far you went in school? Are you prepared to answer that?
As 11 Rise of the Moores members are arraigned in Malden District Court. The group says they do not follow federal or state laws, also not following rules in court today.
Hold on, I have some more questions. You're going to get a full opportunity to speak. I just have a few more questions.
The men say they were traveling from Rhode Island to Maine for training. Prosecutors say the 11 men refused to comply with officers, leading to an hours-long armed standoff with police on I-95.
Other officers showed up and essentially established a perimeter and began to try to negotiate to basically get them to disarm and surrender peacefully. Which they refused to do.
Police identify the two men from Rhode Island as 29-year-old Jamal Latimer of Providence and 40-year-old Quinn Cumberlander of Pawtucket. According to the group, Latimer is the leader and spokesperson. Cumberlander faced the judge first, wearing what appears to be the tactical military-style clothing police say the Rise of the Moores group was wearing during Saturday's incident.
You understand that you are charged with a number of crimes?
No, I do not.
The suspects declining a free court-appointed lawyer, instead asking for a co-defendant to represent them, but the judge says he is not a licensed lawyer in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. The judge calling the charges serious, with possession of a large-capacity firearm holding a maximum penalty of 10 years in state prison. And Cumberlander and Latimer were both held without bail and are both due back in court on Friday for a dangerousness hearing. In Medford, I'm Brittany Schaefer, 12 News.
Since you're my special friend, come closer for a special treat. I'm going to let you touch me in a special place.
It is never okay to touch someone else's private parts. Your mom and dad will tell you so.
The tentative legal settlement between the Boy Scouts of America and tens of thousands of sexual abuse survivors is one of the largest in U.S. history. The National Organization of Boy Scouts filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy in the winter of 2020. And as John Yang tells us, there are now concerns about how much survivors will receive.
Judy, the proposal is a first step in settling the more than 80,000 claims against the Boy Scouts for decades of sexual abuse. And lawyers who negotiated the deal on behalf of survivors of the abuse say there could be a lot more money to come. In a statement, the Boy Scouts of America called it a significant step toward a global resolution of those claims. The deal must still be approved by a bankruptcy judge, and other attorneys representing survivors said they'll object to it as too small. Attorney Kenneth Rothweiler represents about 16,000 of those claimants and negotiated the settlement. Mr. Rothweiler, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Have you talked to any of the survivors that you've been you represent, and what's their reaction to what they're hearing about this?
Yeah, I talk to survivors every day, and I always get their opinion as to how they're feeling and how they perceive the whole bankruptcy going. I mean, I wouldn't say they're overjoyed, but they feel satisfied because the Boy Scouts have acknowledged what they've done, and now they've come to the table, and compensation is coming to the survivors.
When we hear numbers like this and settlements like this, I mean, this is big, but how much of that money, after fees, after other expenses, how much of that money is going to actually end up in survivors' pockets? Is there any way of estimating that at this stage?
It's hard to estimate it at this time, John, because we're not finished yet. I mean, this settlement with the BSA and the locals is just the first step, and that's always been the plan, to get the settlement with those two entities and then to get the insurance rights, which have now been assigned to the trust, so that we can go after the insurance companies. And that's where actually most of the money is. So I predict that in the end, this is going to be a multi-billion dollar settlement.
And will all the claimants get the same amount, or will it different amounts to different claims?
Different amount to different claimants, depending upon what state they're in, the severity of the abuse, the longevity of the abuse. There's a lot of factors that go into it. It's called a TDP. It's a trust distribution protocol, which is basically guidelines for the trustee to assess how much each individual claimant will get.
When the Boy Scouts of America filed for bankruptcy, there was a lot of controversy because the local councils weren't involved. And a lot of people were saying that's where a significant amount of the assets were being held. So where is the money for this this settlement? Where is the money coming from?
Well, it's a total of $850 million. $250 million is from the national organization, the National Boy Scouts of America. $600 million is from the local councils, and there's about 250 local councils, and that's broken down into cash and property and a promissory note. So we tried to extract as much money as we could for survivors, both from the BSA National and from the 250 local councils.
And will this limit the liability of the councils after this settlement?
Yeah, they'll be getting what's called a channeling injunction, which means that, their potential exposure has ended.
And there's more than just money in this settlement. What do you think are some of the more significant other provisions?
Well, on behalf of the survivors, I can tell you that it's never been about the money. It's been about the recognition from the Boy Scouts that this abuse went on for decades. And the survivors feel good about the fact that the Boy Scouts have acknowledged that. And now we move on from there.
And there are, as I noted in the introduction, there are some attorneys who are not thrilled about this, who say it's too small, who say that you can't really judge how equitable it is until you know how much the local councils really have. What's your response?
Well, my response to it is those lawyers don't know what the plan was from the beginning. The plan always was to get a settlement with the BSA National and then the locals and then move on to the insurers. And as I told you, John, in the beginning, you know, there's billions of potential dollars that could come from the insurance companies, also from chartering organizations like the LDS Church. And for, I mean, from sponsoring organizations like the LDS Church and also from chartering organizations. So there's a lot of potential money that can come the way of the survivors. We now have to be aggressive as the lawyers to go after it.
Will the survivors have a say in accepting this plan and whether the, I mean, the bankruptcy, it's ultimately up to the bankruptcy judge, but will the survivors have a say in this?
They will. I mean, they will ultimately vote on the plan. So they will, their votes will be counted, and a certain percentage of the survivors have to vote in favor of it for the plan to go through. So yes, they will have a vote.
And you say that this is just the beginning. There are others to go after. How long do you think this process is ultimately going to take?
It depends how much the insurers fight us, John, quite frankly. You know, if they come to the table and will talk to us, we could get this done by the end of the year. If they don't do that, then we'll have to litigate against them. And we've got a lot of good lawyers involved in this bankruptcy that are ready to litigate against the major insurance companies. So we'll have to wait and see. Probably a better question after a couple months.
Kenneth Rothweiler, who's representing claims of sexual abuse against the Boy Scouts of America. Thank you very much.
Thanks, John. Appreciate it.
Genocide school. While most of us think of schools as a social good, in the history of some people, that has not been the case. Among Canada's Indigenous people, those we have come to call Indians, schools have become a place of pain, sorrow, and loss. For the better part of a century, these schools, called residential schools, were where Indigenous children came to be whipped, punished, and traumatized for the sin of not being white. First run by the government and later by the Roman Catholic Church, these schools became a site of horror, torture, and death. Recently, the ground surrounding the residential school in Kamloops, British Columbia, revealed the graves of over 200 Indigenous children. Subsequent searches have found hundreds of other children around so-called residential schools. I recently read a book by Native leader George Manuel, 1921-1989, entitled The Fourth World, published in 1974, who wrote of his school years in the following way. Three things stand out in my mind. Hunger, speaking English, and being called a heathen because of my grandfather. On the day we arrived at the school, each new boy was assigned an interpreter who was a senior student. All the teachers were monks or devout lay Catholics. We called them brothers. In my first meeting with brothers, he showed me a long black leather strap and told me, through my interpreter, if you are ever caught speaking Indian, this is what you will get across your hands. Manuel, 63-64. Kamloops, British Columbia, Canada. A site of genocide school. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Why? white supremacy is a sickness.
Now, the staggering death toll from COVID-19. As we mark more than 4 million dead around the world, the actual number will likely never be known. And as the U.S. and other wealthy nations with relatively high vaccination rates begin emerging from the pandemic, the disease and its variants are accelerating in some parts of the world, killing more quickly than ever. Nick Schifrin begins our coverage.
As South Africa walks through the valley of the shadow of death, there is plenty of fear and little comfort.
The deaths are now not numbers on a news station. These are people you know. It's family. It's relatives. It's friends. It's colleagues.
Dr. Kgosi Letlape is a physician and activist in Johannesburg. He says while the U.S. is normalizing, the world and Africa are struggling because of vaccine shortages.
If it stays like that, not only are we not safe, the world will also not be safe.
On a day like today, it's difficult to comprehend. 4 million, equal to the victims of every war everywhere for the last 40 years, equal to the entire population of Los Angeles, equal to the entire nation of Georgia. Back in Johannesburg, these COVID patients are the lucky ones. They have beds in makeshift clinics set up by volunteer medics. South Africa's public hospitals are overflowing. Healthcare workers are overwhelmed. A third COVID wave is driven by an expanding Delta variant and shrinking vaccine supply.
That is our single biggest challenge right now. But a lot of the Western governments have stockpiles of vaccine. Let's release those to where they are needed right now and increase production of vaccines globally.
South Africa's story is a global one. As Delta spreads through countries with few vaccines, hospitalizations and deaths are at new highs. It took 9 months for 1 million to die, but the death toll rose from 3 million to 4 million in just 2.5 months. In the U.S., the Delta variant is quickly spreading. In some areas, it accounts for 80% of cases, CDC Director Rochelle Walensky said today.
This rapid rise is troubling. We know that the Delta variant has increased transmissibility, and it is currently surging in pockets of the country with low vaccination rates.
But at least much of the U.S. is vaccinated. Much of the world's governments can't vaccinate their own people. And at this point, vaccines are the only way out, as White House COVID coordinator Jeffrey Zients admitted today.
It's another life protected, another community that is safer, and another step toward putting this pandemic behind us that has sadly taken more than 600,000 lives here at home and a total of 4 million lives around the world.
4 million people. And in the 2.5 minutes since this story began, another 15 people died of COVID. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Nick Schifrin.
Let's fill in more of the global picture and the struggle to vaccinate as the Delta variant spreads. Dr. Jennifer Nazo is an epidemiologist who watches this closely at the Johns Hopkins University Center for Global Health Security. Dr. Nazo, welcome back to the NewsHour. And as we say, someone who has watched this closely from the beginning, what's the significance to you of this 4 million milestone?
I mean, it's just an absolutely staggering, very grim milestone to reach. And it's terrible just to think that we've lost 4 million human beings, but also knowing that that's probably an undercount, because being able to diagnose infection and count deaths is frankly a luxury that a lot of places in the world don't have have the ability to do. And, you know, I reflect on COVID in 2021, and I think about the fact that we now have in production and availability vaccines, tools that can prevent these deaths. The fact that we have added more deaths since the invention of vaccines for COVID than we had beforehand, it's just an utter tragedy. I mean, these deaths can be prevented if we are able to get vaccines to where they need to go.
And as we saw in that report from Nick Schifrin, the picture in the rest of the world is just utterly grim. The WHO was saying today the continent of Africa this past week, its worst ever.
Yeah, I mean, I think in the beginning part of this pandemic, there was this false narrative that this was a virus that was only affecting rich countries, and that there were certain countries and parts of the world that were largely spared. We are now seeing that that was an absolutely false assumption. And unfortunately, I think it maybe took off some of the pressure to make sure that we not only developed vaccines, but that we developed plans, real operational plans to make sure we share the vaccines that we do produce. And we are seeing this virus ravage all parts of the globe, and really any country that, as of now, hasn't been able to vaccinate large portions of its population and haven't had a large surge of cases remains perilously at risk. We are seeing the virus surging in parts of the world where they had been previously successful in containing the spread of the virus, but these new variants outpace those efforts. It's very hard to keep up with the traditional public health methods that countries have been using. And really the only pathway to the prevention of this incredible loss of life and to return to normal for the globe is to ensure that all countries have access to vaccines so that they can protect their population.
Well, how do you get that done? We heard the doctor say in that report, the rest of the world, there's a stockpile of vaccines. What needs to happen? I mean, the U.S. is now shipping, what, half a billion plus doses. Other wealthy countries are shipping some vaccines to poorer countries.
Yeah, so a number of countries have pledged vaccines, which is really important. I mean, the G7 has come up with about a 2 billion vaccine pledge. You know, that is important, and I don't want to undersell what an incredible achievement that is. That said, the estimates are that we need about 5.5 billion vaccines. So first of all, we need to figure out a way to make more and to make more quickly. And the other thing that we need to do is make sure that these pledges turn into actual vaccines shipped to where they need to be going. And unfortunately, some of those efforts are really falling behind schedule. We have a very narrow window of time to act. If I see a proposal for sharing vaccines or making more vaccines that stretches beyond a year, I have to actually question how much of an impact it's going to have, because we need vaccines right now to save the most amount of lives. This virus is moving across the planet really quickly, so it's essential that we get vaccines in arms as quickly as possible. And really, in the next few months, it's going to be absolutely critical.
So you're talking about policy decisions, policy changes at the highest levels here in the United States and in other countries. And then we had the announcement today from Pfizer that it may be within just a few weeks of seeking U.S. authorization for a booster, a third shot, which presumably would be in big demand here in the United States.
Yeah, so I think we have to have some tough conversations about how we're going to use the vaccines that exist on the planet. To date, about 75% of the world's vaccines have been used by only a handful of countries, and they are all high-income countries. I think when we are talking about using vaccines in low priority populations, when we're thinking about, you know, possibly giving a third booster, I think we have to really have a hard look at whether that's an ethical thing to do or if that's something that we can do later, after some of the world has had an opportunity to protect its most vulnerable, to at least protect their healthcare workers who put their lives on the line every day. If we let countries put their healthcare workers at risk and they lose those healthcare workers, those countries are not going to be ready for future events. The fact that all of us have had to sit home at various points in this pandemic has been because we are acutely concerned about the ability of health systems to be able to respond to a surge of cases. So you can imagine that if we allow healthcare workers to get infected and not be able to care for patients, that countries are just going to be absolutely crippled by that. So, you know, I think we have to have a hard look at how we're using the vaccines that are in existence now. And, you know, in my view, talk about a booster, except for some, you know, very limited populations that we don't think have mounted an immune response from the vaccine doses that they've received to date. I think it's really premature to be talking about that when the vast majority of the world has not even had access to one shot.
Some very, very tough trade-offs that certainly deserve addressing. Dr. Jennifer Nazo with the Johns Hopkins University Center for Global Health Security. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is the city of Chicago.
There are still a lot of people across the Chicago region who have not gotten vaccinated against COVID-19. In many South Suburban communities, only about a quarter of the population have gotten their shots. WBEZ's Becky Vivi reports.
Catherine Bidays is sitting inside the gymnasium of Thornton Township High School on a hot summer Saturday. She's 17 and just got her first dose of a COVID-19 vaccine.
It was just that I didn't find the right time. And then they would tell me, oh, we're not doing vaccinations on kids yet.
B Benes was one of 70 people who came through the pop-up vaccination site in Harvey on the last Saturday it was open. Officials say it was actually one of the busiest days that the South Suburban Mass vaccination site had back when it was still open.
We haven't gotten the business that we've wanted to get.
Dr. Rachel Rubin is co-lead of the Cook County Department of Public Health and says now they're taking a different approach.
It's very hard, and I think we really need to be now going door to door with outreach and say, we have a van that's doing vaccinations. It's in the elementary schoolyard, a block away from you. And we take a concentric circle around that school and we do outreach and we knock on all doors and say, we're going to be here all weekend.
As of the end of June, less than a quarter of Harvey residents were fully vaccinated against COVID-19. And the same is true across the south suburbs. A WBEZ analysis of Cook County vaccination data found that the 10 towns with the lowest vaccination rates are all majority black suburbs south of the city that were hit hard by the pandemic. Dr. Lisa Green is the CEO of Family Christian Health Center, which operates clinics in Harvey and nearby Dalton. She says when things started reopening, that had a huge impact on the vaccination campaign in these places.
For the people who were on the fence, this just gave a lot of people the ability to say, I'm good. And you're left exposed because your diabetes didn't leave yesterday just because the city opened back up.
Across the Chicago region, cases and deaths are way down. For many, it feels like the pandemic is just over. In fact, the top 10 most vaccinated suburbs in Cook County are all well over 70%. They're also all affluent and predominantly white. That's not the reality in the south suburbs, where Green says people still have a lot of real questions and concerns about the science, the side effects, and the long-term implications.
Great for those communities that have that vaccine, you know, that's there. That shows them, guess what? They didn't die. They're not glowing, and they don't have 10 arms. So we could use that as an example, right?
Green says there's an urgency, though, to getting more people vaccinated in the south suburbs this summer.
What happens is you leave these communities unvaccinated, then you risk that variant getting stronger. This changes to something else, then the rest of us that are back, you know, eating out at our cafes and back in the office and thinking that we're good because we're vaccinated, that risk factor changes too.
That's why on-the-ground outreach at church events, barbecues, local picnics is so important, she says.
We break it down to your city, your block, your neighborhood. This is where you live. This is what's happening here. These are the number of people who got infected. These are the number of your neighbors that died. And so as we break it down like that, it's beginning to move things.
The numbers in the south suburbs do show slow progress. Even though just 23% of Harvey residents are fully vaccinated, that number was in the teens just a month ago. Back at the Thornton Township High School on that last weekend it was open as a mass vaccination site, Cheryl Jones with the Harvey Area Chamber of Commerce was set up at a table outside. She says her message to her neighbors who are still unvaccinated is simple.
People are still getting sick. People are still going to the hospital. And people are dying. So we can't do that. We can't let our guard down. I don't care if it is warm weather and we're outside.
Because if the pandemic taught us anything, she says, it's that we're all more connected than we realize. Becky Vivi, WBEZ News.
WBEZ's Matt Kiefer contributed reporting.
You're dirt. We think you're dirt, Paul.
Who is we?
The West. All the superpowers. Everything you believe in, Paul. They think you're dirt. They think you're dumb. You're worthless.
I'm afraid I don't understand what you are saying, sir.
Oh, come on. Don't bullshit me, Paul. You're the smartest man here. You got them all eating out of your hands. You could own this freaking hotel, except for one thing. You're black. You're not even a nigger. You're an African.
The Delta variant is rapidly spreading across the African continent in a third wave of COVID-19 infections. And only about 1% of Africans are fully vaccinated against COVID-19, making people vulnerable. The majority of African countries participate in COVAX, a global initiative created to improve equity in vaccine distribution. But vaccines haven't reached people as efficiently as hoped. Dr. Fiona Atuhebwe is the World Health Organization's new vaccines introduction officer for Africa. The WHO is one of the organizations leading COVAX.
Right now, African countries
are at a point where we shall take any vaccine handed to us. But right from the beginning, the COVAX facility had set a minimum of 50% efficacy. For all the scientific studies showed, if a vaccine meets the minimum 50% efficacy rate, then it is able to actually prevent severe disease, hospitalization, and deaths.
I spoke with Dr. Atuhebwe about how individual African countries are doing.
So indeed, some countries are doing better than others. For instance, we have Angola, Eswatini, Gambia, Namibia, Rwanda, Uganda, countries that have used up 100% of their COVAX doses because they all had a robust vaccine rollout. Countries with trained health staff, logistics capacity in place have been able to roll out vaccines the fastest. But we also have countries, the reports on lack of operational funds. In Africa, this time around, there was no vaccine introduction grant to help them roll out the vaccine, to train health workers, to do the communication and social mobilization, to transport these vaccines from the national stores to the subnational stores, and then finally to the service delivery points.
You spoke about some of the success stories here and some of the challenges, but there are some 20 countries that received doses but didn't roll out more than half of them. What were the challenges there? And also, what countries aren't doing so well and what are the challenges there?
So the World Bank estimates that Africa will need about $12 billion for procurement and distribution of COVID-19 vaccines to reach sufficient numbers to ensure adequate protection of the African population. And many countries, African countries, must fund the costs of procuring the additional vaccines, while at the same time investing in immunization systems to be able to distribute the vaccine. Then we also have seen an issue with vaccine acceptance. We know that we have disparities between, for example, Western Central Africa, which have a low vaccine confidence, and then East and Southern Africa that have a higher vaccine confidence.
So what accounts for the variance in vaccine acceptance?
Different countries in Africa were affected at different levels by the pandemic. So there are countries that still think that COVID is still a myth. To them, they have not seen the real impact of COVID, so they think it's something political. Then we have late community engagement. The vaccines arrive in the countries before the communities are engaged and education has not yet taken place. So it's difficult for them to understand, is this vaccine going to cause the disease? Is it something, again, the usual Western world trying to finish Africa? Things like that. But we've also noted the level of trust by the public in their government and medical institutions. We've had a lot of African presidents, for example, come out and publicly get vaccinated to increase confidence in the population. And that has worked in many countries where the heads of state have been publicly vaccinated.
How much of this incredibly low vaccination rate is really about vaccine hesitancy versus lack of access?
So there's a myth that vaccine supply shortages are contributing to vaccine hesitancy, which is not what we are finding as WHO. And this has come from this third wave that has hit the continent. Because of the Delta variant that we know that, and we've seen that the transmissibility is really high, if they brought in doses right now, much more doses, this is the right time to vaccinate Africa, because people have seen the impact of what these other waves have done to us, and they now are willing to take the vaccine.
How do you get the needed vaccines into the countries that need them right now?
Right now, to be honest, we are at the mercy of the richer countries that are having much more vaccine than they require. Given that in Africa, we have not even vaccinated 1% of our population, let alone vaccinating the priority groups. We have health workers in Africa working in COVID treatment centers and have not been vaccinated because they cannot access the vaccine dose. And that ethical and moral obligation that we think the Western world has to the African population, we know that we are a global village. See what the Delta variant has now done, even to countries that have vaccinated huge populations.
And there's been some setbacks, too. Many African countries were supposed to receive vaccines from India, but then India's own COVID crisis led to export restrictions. What's being done to replace those vaccines that were expected?
One, the cry out for donations and the G7 countries responding and more countries that had extra doses responding and donating some of their doses to Africa. This can never meet what we were expecting to get from India, but that's just a small part. Then, as you know, the COVAX facility is also exploring increasing the manufacturing sites for the AstraZeneca. But also, the WHO has really expedited and increased the number of approved vaccines for emergency use listing. So now we've added the Chinese vaccines, the Johnson & Johnson, which we are also anticipating in later in the third quarter, and much more of the Johnson & Johnson doses at the beginning of the year.
So really a crisis moment, taking whatever you can get to make sure people have some type of immunity against this variant.
Exactly. And we are saying that every African should take the vaccine they first land their hands on. What we need right now is immunity.
Dr. Atuhebwa, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And moving on, you remind everybody at the end of your report about sobriety is best. I would have liked Ms. Richardson to also have adhered to that. I know as an athlete that she put a lot of time and energy towards reaching a particular goal that is not as easy as a lot of people think it is, being that she's young. Yes, you probably can go to another Olympic Games, but it's not as easy as a lot of people think it is at all. And I also suspect also that she was using marijuana long before her mother died, but I could be wrong. Sobriety is best.
We now know that Sha'Carri Richardson won't be going to the Tokyo Olympics at all this summer. The story began last week when the American sprinter was disqualified for one event for a positive marijuana test. This week, she was left off the team entirely. Following the news of her initial suspension, Sha'Carri revealed in an interview with the Today Show that she had used marijuana in Oregon, where it's legal, to cope with the recent death of her biological mother. Her suspension has raised questions about the history of anti-cannabis policies and the exceedingly high standards Olympic athletes are held to in this regard. Joining me now to discuss is Hayes Brown, writer and editor for MSNBC Daily, and Kavitha Davidson, sports and culture writer at The Athletic, host of the podcast Culture Calculus, and co-author of the book Loving Sports When They Don't Love You Back, The Dilemmas of the Modern Fan. Welcome to both of you to WNYC. Thank you so much for coming on.
Well, thank you for having us.
Glad to be here.
So, Kavitha, just a few weeks ago, a lot of us didn't know who Sha'Carri Richardson was, but for track and field fans, she's been a star for a long time. So can you tell us about her career, maybe even going back to high school or at LSU?
Yeah, I mean, Sha'Carri Richardson is part of a very longstanding lineage of fantastic runners from LSU. She's only 21 years old. She posted a 10:48 time in the 100-meter sprint in her Olympic trials, which has now been disqualified because of that positive test. But off record, she is the fastest woman in America. And it's really a detriment to all of us and to the Olympics, to USATF, and honestly, to any track and field fan that she is not going to be competing in these Olympics this year.
And Hayes, as you point out in your piece, on top of the 30-day suspension, USA Track and Field did announce on Tuesday that Sha'Carri would not participate in the 4x100 relay set to take place on August 5th and 6th, days after her initial 30-day suspension would technically expire. So whose decision was it for her not to participate for the United States at all? Was it the U.S. Olympic Committee or the International Olympic Committee? Is it even clear how that came about?
So it's not entirely clear when the decision was made, but it is clear who made the decision. It's a decision that would come from the national side. It would come from USA Track and Field or the U.S. Olympic Committee, one of the two, that would have made the call that said that despite the fact that, as you said, her 30-day suspension would be over, that she would not be able to, she would not be competing in the 4x100 relay. And there are several reasons why that could be. Maybe it's a matter of cohesion in terms of the team and that the team had already been set. But as Kavitha just said, she is technically the fastest woman in America right now. So it's a real disappointment that there was not a slot given to her on this squad, given both, you know, the excitement around her and the fact that she is a tremendous athlete, that she, despite this, the suspension, would in fact probably help the U.S. get to the podium in this event.
And Kavitha, I think the question that a lot of people are asking, kind of bottom line, if marijuana is not a performance-enhancing drug, and even further, if it's legal in the place where she used it, why is there a crackdown against it? Why is there a prohibition against it in the first place for Olympic athletes?
Yeah, I think these are two separate but also the same questions. As you said, Brian, she used it in Oregon, which is a state where marijuana is legal for recreational use. She also used it to cope with the loss of her biological mother, which I think that a lot of people can probably have some compassion and empathy for. At the same time, WADA, the World Anti-Doping Agency, does have marijuana as a banned substance. Now, they've listed as a banned substance under the Substance of Abuse Clause, which basically means that it is against the spirit of the sport to use a substance like marijuana, which I think speaks to a lot of moralizing about a quote-unquote drug that has been legalized in almost 20 states in the United States. The other aspect of that is the performance enhancing aspect, which is very interesting because WADA does like to cite a 2011 study about why marijuana is on the banned substance list that tends to point to certain performance enhancing aspects of marijuana, while also saying that it is detrimental to the athlete's health because it impairs motor function. And those two things seem to be directly in contradiction with each other. So there are a lot of questions going forward. And unfortunately for Sha'Carri and for all of us, I think she's going to end up becoming the face of an overhaul of this rule going forward.
On the argument that it can be performance enhancing, I guess they cite things like people use marijuana for pain relief, people use marijuana for anxiety relief, but is Prozac a banned drug? Is acetaminophen a banned drug? You know what I mean? That people use for those same conditions.
Well, caffeine or alcohol, you can also add, I think, to those categories. Yeah, those are really big questions going forward. I think that anybody who is aware of the science, at least, is going to question the performance-enhancing nature of marijuana, especially if you are running. And a lot of people have brought up the fact that WADA has marijuana on the banned substance list as a one-size-fits-all banned substance, and that obviously should not be the case. And it should not be the case also in a world in which more than 40 countries have some form of decriminalized recreational use laws for marijuana. So when you compare it to other things that are legal to use, it does seem to be incongruous with other rules that WADA has.
And some of this, Hayes, is just like a morals clause, like it has nothing to do with performance enhancement. But if you use cocaine, you're bad. If you use marijuana, you're bad. Is it like that?
Yeah, it absolutely is. And I will point out that this substance that could be abused clause that's in the WADA anti-doping list, it's a new addition. Previously, it was these drugs like cocaine, heroin, marijuana were all just carpet banned substances as well. But the way that they rewrote the rule, much like U.S. law, where marijuana, federally at least, is considered a Schedule I drug that is in the same category as heroin and cocaine, that's the same thing applies in the WADA rule, in the WADA rules, that marijuana is treated the exact same as these drugs that actually kill thousands of people every year due to overdose. And I think that, yeah, that it does have a very significant moralizing tinge to it, this decision, that isn't really backed up by the science, isn't really backed up by the reasoning that they give for banning all these other substances.
But the United Parcel Service and the people at the post office didn't call you back because you had clouded piss. So now you're back in a trap. Just that. Trap. Go on to marinate on that for a minute.
That's right. We move it to Mississippi. And you know how that's spelled. M-I- crooked letter, I. Crooked letter, crooked letter, I. Hook back, I.
A bitter fight has broken out between powerful backers who want to put a large grain terminal on the Mississippi River in South Louisiana and the historic black community that exists only yards from the fence line. Charges of environmental racism are coming from the descendants of enslaved people who believe the silo complex is an existential threat to their community. NPR's John Burnett reports from Wallace, Louisiana.
It's Juneteenth. A couple dozen folks, mostly extended family, have come out to visit under a three-century-old oak tree. They eat roast beef sandwiches and peach cobbler, drink whiskey and daiquiris, and enjoy the laid-back rural life on this lazy bend of the mighty Mississippi. But they fear change is coming.
My name is Joy Banner, and I have grown up here my whole life. We're in Wallace, Louisiana. We don't want this way of life to be ruined. Is becoming more rare, primarily because of so much industrialization.
Joy Banner and the rest of this predominantly African-American town are alarmed at the plans of Greenfield Louisiana LLC. The company wants to put in grain elevators to store more than 4 million bushels of corn, wheat, and soybeans. The grain will float down the Mississippi River in barges from the Midwest and get loaded onto cargo ships here in Wallace that will deliver it around the globe. Supporters from the governor's office to the local parish council say it will create jobs and expand international trade, but neighbors see a massive industrial complex with one structure as tall as the Statue of Liberty, operating 24/7 with truck and train traffic, machinery noise, and dust escaping when grain is loaded and unloaded. Banner stands at the edge of her unincorporated village, looking out over a field of sugarcane, the crop her enslaved ancestors cut from dawn to dusk.
This property is where the proposed grain elevator site would be set up, right next to us. As you can see, we would be living in the middle of this facility.
Some 200 industrial and petrochemical plants are located along the twisting river between Baton Rouge and New Orleans. This industrial corridor has been nicknamed Cancer Alley. Study after study has shown that poor black communities near toxic air pollution suffer greater rates of cancer. People at the Juneteenth picnic say their air is already foul, and a giant grain elevator next door is bound to make things worse. Lawrence Alexis is a 93-year-old resident who used to work in a sugar refinery.
Well, you got red dust, black dust, white dust, all these plants, they all got dust.
In a thick Creole accent, Alexis says the plants up and down the river already produce red dust, black dust, and white dust. He's afraid the grain terminal will create even more dust, and he doesn't think it should be allowed right next to their town.
And I don't think it should be there. Not close like that.
Lawrence Alexis has good reason to worry.
You know, we tend to think of grain as something that's not toxic, not harmful, but the reality is that the dust that comes from these facilities is not pure grain, right? It's grain dust mixed with bacteria, bird droppings, rat droppings, insect parts, lots of things that could irritate your lungs and also potentially include toxins.
Kimberly Terrell is a research scientist at the Tulane Environmental Law Clinic, which is representing Wallace residents in their fight to stop the grain terminal.
The other big issue is that when you have dust in the air and you have facilities releasing toxic air pollution, that dust can essentially be a vehicle for toxics to get deep into your lungs and into your bloodstream.
But there are concerns that go beyond grain dust. Among the founders of Wallace were emancipated slaves who toiled on nearby plantations. The attachment of their descendants to this soil is sacred and as deep as the oak roots. Joy Banner and her twin sister Jo run a cafe in Wallace called the Fifole, named for the mysterious flickering lights in the swamp. They use recipes for tea cakes and pralines handed down from their great-great-grandmother, Mama Jo, who was born into slavery. And they still tell the legend of the gown man, said to originate with a slave owner who dressed as a ghostly figure to frighten his slaves into obedience.
Like, these stories are an example of the way that we continue the networks that our ancestors sought to maintain. It's sad that we're constantly threatened by being pushed out
of something that our ancestors wanted for us.
The proposed Greenfield, Louisiana terminal will help, not harm, the community, says CEO Adam Johnson. Johnson says in a statement, the state-of-the-art grain elevators will diversify the tax base and create 100 jobs. The company says it will significantly reduce environmental impacts by using fully enclosed conveyor systems and installing dust collection devices. The local elected officials who support the project all declined interviews. State Agriculture Commissioner Mike Strain says the Wallace Grain Terminal fits into a larger project to build modern port facilities, deepen the river, and make Louisiana more globally competitive.
It is good for Wallace, Louisiana. The ports are the lifeblood of many, you know, different communities, and the Port of South Louisiana provides jobs, local jobs, and a boost to the local economy.
Others believe the proposed Wallace Grain Terminal is just the latest example of environmental racism.
I don't think industry saw a black community as a viable community. I think they just ignored it. And to me, that smacks of a type of racism.
Craig Colton is professor emeritus of geography and anthropology at Louisiana State University. He's written about race, history, and heavy industry along the River Road. And he says it's common for petrochemical corporations to buy former plantation property and build plants just across the fence line from freedmen's towns.
There are many of these little linear villages that were a relic of plantations and that were predominantly African American. And oftentimes these plants are situated adjacent to those or very close to those.
The proposed grain elevator would also be located less than a half mile from the historic Whitney Plantation. It's an acclaimed museum complex dedicated to the telling of the slave experience. Rather than gushing over the Greek Revival architecture and the graceful oak alleys, docents at the Whitney explain the brutal labor conditions and the little-known 1811 slave revolt along River Road. Again, Joy Banner, the community activist leading the fight, who's also communications director for the Whitney.
We have a great opportunity from historic cultural tourism. So there would be dust and grain and noise that would be part of the museum experience, would be negative.
Finally, the principal behind the grain terminal is San Francisco activist investor Christopher James. He recently made headlines when his investment firm, Engine No. 1, achieved the unthinkable by installing three directors on the board of ExxonMobil to pressure the company to reduce carbon emissions. Climate activists lauded him as a green David battling the petro-Goliath. Opponents in Wallace see him in a different light. They say the secretive permitting process has up to now shut them out. But when the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers considers Greenfield's application later this year, they plan to speak up loudly and say, "Don't let the grain terminal destroy this slave descendants community." John Burnett, NPR News, Wallace, Louisiana.
A promising new drug to treat obesity got approved for sale this month in clinical trials. Wegovy helped people drop an average of 15% of their body weight, far more than other drugs on the market. But as NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports, a major question remains: will insurers cover its cost for the many millions of people who might benefit?
Marlene Greenleaf's entire family in Trinidad struggled with obesity.
My husband has diabetes. My sister has diabetes. My brother has diabetes.
Greenleaf is 58 and an administrator at a charter school in Washington, D.C. She tried numerous diets. They all failed. In 2018, she joined a clinical trial of a new drug, a once-weekly shot that changes the way her brain signals hunger. She noticed the change immediately.
With the medication, there was something that triggered in my brain to tell me that I was not hungry. I also wanted to eat healthier. I was looking at options, reading labels, looking at the calories, not just the calories, but also the sugar.
She didn't crave her favorite chocolate chip cookies. Over the 68-week trial, she dropped 40 pounds. Her blood pressure fell, which qualified her to donate her kidney to her husband, who was on dialysis.
It was one of the best gifts of life that I could have ever done because of this.
But after the trial, Greenleaf regained some of the weight. Now she wants to resume the Wegovy shots.
My only challenge actually is getting the insurance company to approve it.
Insurance coverage, it turns out, is a giant question, not just with Wegovy, but with obesity drugs in general. The out-of-pocket price can reach $1,000 to $1,500 a month, putting it out of reach for many, unless insurance covers it. Some private insurers do cover obesity drugs, though it's too early to tell whether Wegovy will be. America's Health Insurance Plans, the industry's trade group, declined comment. Medicare does not cover medicines for obesity, but some state Medicaid programs do. Fatima Cody Stanford is a leading obesity researcher at Harvard. She's closely followed the Wegovy trial.
I'm excited about it.
Stanford says the drug acts on the brain so people eat less and store less of what they eat. That helps address the excess weight, but it also helps with numerous related diseases of the liver or heart, for example. And there are few side effects to boot. But, she says, it will be of little use if it's not also affordable for patients.
Before I even bring up that drug with my patients, I'm looking to see which insurance they're having on the left side of my screen, because that will determine whether I bring it up, because if it's out of reach, I won't bring it up.
Stanford says her patients on existing obesity medications do extraordinary things to keep their coverage so they can stay on them.
Several nurses here at the hospital that are my patients stayed working. They were supposed to retire, stayed employed so they could stay on their injectable medication because that's how beneficial it was to them.
Douglas Langa is executive vice president of the North American division of Novo Nordisk. The company makes both Wegovy and the current market leader, a drug called Saxenda. Wegovy triples Saxenda's average weight loss. But Langa acknowledges it's hard to get doctors, patients, and politicians to recognize obesity as a disease, and that therefore insurance should cover drugs to treat it.
There's a medical component to this that needs to be recognized. This is a disease state like we should be treating any other disease state.
And that's also what Langa is telling insurance companies, making the case for why prescriptions for Wegovy should be covered. His company is also heavily lobbying Congress to pass legislation to allow Medicare to cover obesity medications. He argues it makes sense. It's the root disease underlying so many others.
We do believe that insurers understand that this is a gateway into 60 other health conditions.
And, he says, the need is hard to ignore. More than 100 million people in the U.S. alone struggle with obesity. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News.
I want to be a cop.
The ability to quickly pull out a phone and record instances of police violence has revealed patterns of racial bias across many of America's police departments in the last decade. But what could the internal records of police departments reveal?
Okay, and was he saying anything at this time?
Yeah, at one point, I don't remember if he was yelling, "Go get my mama, somebody get my mama." I kind of thought, well, that's a little bit odd because I thought he was an adult.
In the state of California, records and tapes like these of internal affairs investigations within police departments used to be secret. Then in 2018, a police transparency law in the state unsealed hundreds of these recordings. KQED's Suki Lewis and Sandhya Dirks have been investigating these records for the new podcast from KQED and NPR called On Our Watch. The fourth episode is about something that happened to Joseph Green when he was 16 years old in Stockton, California.
I never even touched Officer Johnson, not once.
Has he ever pushed him?
Never pushed him. I couldn't push him if I'm walking out the door like this and he come up and grabbed me by my hair.
Sandhya Dirks reported this episode, and just a word of warning, this story contains explicit descriptions of violence and may not be appropriate for all audiences. Hey, Sandhya.
Hi, Elsa.
So, Joseph Green's case is unfortunately one that has become all too familiar to us. I mean, it involves violence by a white police officer towards a black teenager. But this case isn't all that well known. It happened in Stockton, which is in California's Central Valley. Can you just start us off by telling us what happened?
So 16-year-old Joseph Green goes into a gas station to pay for gas, and he's got a dollar left over, and he wants to buy some gummy worms for his little sister. Now, the dollar bill that he's using is damaged, and the cashier doesn't want to take it. Behind him in line is a plainclothes Stockton police officer, Officer Robert Johnson III, and he gets involved in this discussion between Green and the clerk. Now, Green turns to leave the store and begins to walk away, but Johnson pulls him back into the store. And both Green and Johnson have these very different versions of what happened next.
Officer Johnson ran up behind me.
So I grabbed him by his sweatshirt.
Grabbed him by my hair.
Pulled him back through the door.
And swung me around and slammed me on the ground. And if that's attempted murder, he could have killed me.
In the end, Johnson arrests Green for trespassing and resisting arrest.
Okay, and this police transparency law that allowed you to access some of these previously secret records, this law doesn't actually require the release of records that solely have to do with racial bias, right? Like, this is a use of force case. So why did you focus specifically on racial bias here?
So yeah, racial bias just wasn't a category of misconduct that ended up being unsealed by SB 1421 or the Right to Know Act. But we do, of course, know that in California, Black people are more likely to be killed, arrested, or have force used on them than white people. And while this was technically a use of force case, to us, it was clearly also about race. There was sort of barely coded language that the police officer used to talk about Joe Green, that he looked like an adult, that he was dangerous and a violent drug dealer. It all felt very clearly like racial profiling. And I mean, you know, sort of think about it. This kid is trying to pay for candy with a ripped dollar bill, and this police officer thinks, oh, he must be a drug dealer?
Right. And Green's mother, Sharonica Champion, I mean, she was pumping gas when all of this happened. She runs into the store, witnesses part of it. And then she later goes into the police department to file a complaint. And it is that complaint that prompts an internal investigation into Johnson.
You've seen all this investigation, but it's all on the tape. So I'll leave it at that. It's all on the tape.
One of the things that she mentions when she's talking to IA investigators is this surveillance video at the store that basically captured the incident between Johnson and her son, Joe Green. And this video is important because it doesn't actually match up with what Johnson wrote in his police report or what he tells the IA investigator. For example, he says that Green pushed him.
I pulled him by the shirt. He immediately turned to me, grabbed me, and pushed me into a shelf. Mm-hmm. And that's when the pushing match went back and forth.
On the video, Green's hands are up. There's no pushing match. Johnson also tells the IA that he thinks Green is a drug dealer because he saw a small digital scale fall on the ground out of Green's sleeve.
I saw a little black digital scale fell out from either somewhere on his left side, his hand, his pocket, or something.
But no digital scale is ever found. It's not booked into evidence. It's never seen on the videotape. Johnson's also undercover, so he needs to show his badge to arrest Green. Johnson says he pulled out his badge to let Green know he was a cop.
Okay, and you had shown your badge and identified yourself as a police officer and said you're now under arrest. Do you think there's any doubt in Mr. Green's mind that your intention was to arrest him?
Oh, no, there was no doubt.
But on the video, he only pulls out his badge after Green has already turned to leave. And when he's asked why he didn't just let Green leave, why he didn't let Green walk away, this is what Johnson says.
Well, yeah, there was all these other people outside. I didn't know what might take place if he gets out there, if he tells these people, who knows what could happen to me. I know that the neighborhood around that market is not very pro-police.
So it sounds like the video just explicitly disproves many parts of Johnson's testimony.
The video directly contradicts Johnson's testimony, but it's never used in the internal affairs interrogation of Johnson. He's never asked about how it doesn't match his story. But the IA does use the video to help it make the finding that when Johnson punched Green in the face, that was an unnecessary use of force. And Johnson is given a 5-day unpaid suspension. But he appeals, and the case goes to an arbitrator. Now, arbitrators are often picked by police unions, and they aren't required to have any police or use of force training. But their decisions are binding. They override the chief and the city. They have the final word on police discipline. And the arbitrator overturns Johnson's suspension. She finds he had a reason to be afraid of the neighborhood because it was, and I'm quoting her, a high-drug, high-gang neighborhood that included a crime-ridden HUD housing development.
Well, all of this was 10 years ago. What's happened since?
Officer Johnson went on to be involved in 2 police shootings, and in one of those, he killed a Black man who was accused of domestic violence. He is still a police officer with the Stockton Police Department. As for Joseph Green, he did receive $710,000 as an award from a civil jury, but he had to wait 9 years for that to happen. I talked to him at that trial, and he says he's still really haunted by all of this. He says he still sees a police officer and gets scared.
I mean, Sandhya, what you have laid out in this episode is a lot of evidence that seems to suggest racial bias was involved in this case. The coded language, the perceptions of the community. Why do you think the Stockton Police Department never even looked into the possibility of racial bias here?
This gets to the heart of the story, and it's not just the Stockton Police Department. In use of force cases, justification is based on what's in an officer's mind, right? If an officer says they fear for their life and that fear is found to be objectively reasonable, then they are allowed to use force. But what if that fear is rooted in bias? From the cases we've looked at, the internal affairs system in California just does not have a mechanism to investigate or interrogate that bias.
Sandhya Dirks is the race and equity reporter at KQED and a reporter with On Our Watch, a podcast from NPR and KQED. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you so much, Sandhya.
Thanks so much.
Inhale. Take one more sip of air. And down to heart center. And namaste.
Namaste.
It's been 6 months since insurrectionists stormed the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. A top priority for the Department of Justice is unraveling the alleged conspiracies behind that attack. Prosecutors say one plot involved a group of militiamen from Southern California led by a former police chief turned yoga instructor. NPR's Tom Dreisbach has that story, and a warning, it features some offensive language.
Less than 2 years before he faced a sweeping criminal indictment for alleged conspiracy, this was Alan Hostetter.
Take a slow, full breath in through your nostrils. Hold it at the top. And then open your mouth and let the breath go.
In the last several years, Hostetter has been a yoga and meditation teacher and self-described sound healer in Orange County. His life had actually taken several turns before then. He was in the Army in the 80s, a cop in the 90s and 2000s, became a police chief in 2009, and retired less than a year later in the small beach city of San Clemente. It's the kind of place with benches engraved with sayings like, "May every sunset bring you peace." And Hostetter seemed to fit in. He had long salt and pepper hair pulled into a ponytail, big beard, and in his videos he would wear these flowing white tunics. One person who went to a Hostetter sound healing class in 2019 told me, quote, "He was like pure love." But that person did not want to go on tape. They were afraid of backlash because of what happened next.
But I never in my wildest dreams thought that I would actually be in a position to have to defend my fellow countrymen and women from domestic enemies.
That's right.
Yeah. But damn it, I'm doing it now.
When COVID-19 broke out, Orange County saw a surge of anti-lockdown protests, and Hostetter was there from the beginning. Most people I spoke to, on the left and right, agree that the moment that turned Hostetter into a leader of this movement came in May of 2020.
And then I'm going to attempt to enter into that fence with a socket wrench and a 9/16 socket, and I'm going to begin the process of dismantling that fence.
San Clemente had put up a chain-link fence by the city's pier to discourage people from congregating. So Hostetter grabbed a piece of that fence and held on. Sheriff's deputies eventually had to cut a hand-shaped hole in the fence so they could handcuff him and arrest him, while protesters cheered him on.
USA! USA!
The Orange County Sheriff's Department says 8 people were arrested that day, including one man in his 70s. That man told me the experience made him view Hostetter as a hero. To others, it was a reckless act during a deadly pandemic. Now more than 5,000 people have died of COVID in Orange County. Some people protested lockdowns because of the effect on their jobs. But Hostetter, records show, earns about $150,000 every year from his government pension. He was more focused on what he viewed as tyrannical government overreach. One of his protest targets was the Democratic mayor of Costa Mesa, Katrina Foley. He and others showed up at her house, where she was leading a city council meeting by Zoom.
You could hear them, you know, yelling, "Fire Foley," and "No mask mandates, masks kill people, COVID isn't real."
In all your career in politics, have you ever experienced something like that before?
Never.
Foley said that during another protest outside her home, they harassed her son. Foley's family wasn't the only target. In the middle of a pandemic, Orange County's health officer resigned after receiving similar threats. This area has a history of far-right activism, but locals told me Hostetter is a uniquely compelling figure. He could bring together disparate groups, yoga students sometimes skeptical of mainstream medicine, and pro-police conservatives. And Hostetter's rhetoric seemed to get increasingly violent. At a rally in July 2020, he said if the founding fathers were alive, they would violently overthrow California Governor Gavin Newsom.
They would have dragged that bastard out by his hair. They would have drug him into the town square. And they'd have given him a choice. They'd have said, Gavin, you can be hung, or you can be torn and feathered and banished. Pick one.
Yeah. Hang him.
One audience member yelled, hang him. Hostetter then said that he was not actually endorsing violence. After January 6th, this type of language got the attention of federal prosecutors. But at the time, Hostetter campaigned alongside and introduced major candidates and office holders for city council, school board, state assembly, and even Congress. After Joe Biden won the presidential election, Hostetter's focus turned from COVID to overturning what he viewed, against all evidence, as a stolen election.
That's not hyperbole when we call it tyranny. That's tyranny. And tyrants and traitors need to be executed as an example.
This is from a video Hostetter posted last November while driving to a pro-Trump rally. Prosecutors allege that around this time, Hostetter was participating in encrypted chats with members of a far-right militia group called the Three Percenters. They allegedly discussed plans to bring body armor, hatchets, and guns to D.C. for January 6th. It's unclear whether Hostetter actually did bring guns.
We are at war in this country. We are at war tomorrow.
On the day before the insurrection, Hostetter spoke at the Rally to Save America in front of the Supreme Court, who's wearing a fedora with an American flag on it. InfoWars host Alex Jones and Trump advisor Roger Stone also spoke at the event. One speaker said Hostetter's group helped pay for the event and said it could not have happened without him.
I will see you all tomorrow at the front lines. We are taking our country back. Thank you all for being
on the morning of January 6th, Hostetter watched Donald Trump's speech and then marched to the Capitol.
Right now, patriots dominate the city of Washington, D.C.
Prosecutors say Hostetter pushed along with the mob into restricted areas on the west terrace of the Capitol, but did not go inside. He did post a photo of himself outside the building, along with a friend who was wearing body armor and a knife. Hostetter called the insurrection, quote, the shot heard round the world, and said, we are just getting started. 5 months later, Hostetter was arrested on charges of conspiracy. He remains free pending trial, and he has pleaded not guilty. He said he actually never met the militiamen he's been charged with, and says the whole insurrection was a setup by the so-called deep state. So I stopped by his apartment in San Clemente to try to talk to him. I rang the doorbell twice.
Okay. No answer.
So I stepped away to write a note and leave a business card. Then Hostetter came out.
Oh, sir. Mr. Hostetter.
Wrong guy.
The former police officer turned yogi, turned protest leader, turned Capitol riot defendant is very recognizable.
I know it's not the wrong guy, but if you don't want to talk, I understand.
He got into an SUV, and before leaving, he rolled down his window to say something.
What's about to change, my friend?
He said, the whole world's about to change, my friend.
What do you mean by that?
Watch the news. Things are about to get real interesting.
Then he said, watch the news. Things are about to get real interesting. And he drove off. When I sent him a message later, he declined an interview because NPR is, quote, fake news. He sent a link to a clip from a movie called Law Abiding Citizen.
I'm going
to
bring the whole diseased, corrupt temple down on
you. The movie's
your head.
About a guy who goes on a vigilante rampage.
It's got to be biblical.
The guy tortures and kills police, prosecutors, and even a judge. It's popular among believers of QAnon. I asked Hostetter if he was trying to imply something by sending it. And he did not reply. Tom Dreisbach, NPR News, San Clemente, California.
The Turner Diaries. It sold over 500,000 copies. Who do you think is buying it? Eric Rudolph, the Olympic bomber. Wade Page, who shut up the Sikh temple. Larry Ford, developing typhoid and cholera. William Krar with the cyanide bomb. Anthrax, ricin, botulism, C4, IEDs. I could go on like this for hours, and all of them are white supremacists.
Thank you.
Some of the nation's most senior law enforcement officials have called the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol domestic terrorism. But what the federal government considers its most serious domestic threats has evolved over time, raising questions about when serious labels like terrorist should be used. Oregon Public Broadcasting's Conrad Wilson reports on a case from long ago, set to go to trial this year, that will put those questions to a test.
In 2006, then-Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez walked up to a podium at the Justice Department in Washington, D.C.
Good afternoon.
Where he proceeded to lay out the charges against a Pacific Northwest-based cell of animal rights and environmental extremists.
The indictment tells a story of 4.5 years of arson, vandalism, violence, and destruction claimed to have been executed on behalf of the Animal Liberation Front, or Earth Liberation Front, extremist movements known to support acts of domestic terrorism.
Though no one died, 18 people were indicted as part of a conspiracy that caused millions of dollars in damages across 5 Western states during the mid to late 90s.
Obviously, I'm not going to talk about the substance of anything in my case, but pretty much everything is open game other than that.
That's Joseph Deeby, one of those charged by the government for crimes in several states. In Oregon, prosecutors say Deeby helped destroy a slaughterhouse that sold horse meat. Deeby was ultimately arrested in 2018. He's pleaded not guilty, and he's adamant he's not a terrorist.
This case sort of exemplifies the government's, like, this whole hyperbole about terrorism and, you know, hippies being terrorists. That's rubbish.
Deeby's case comes as the country debates what is and is not considered domestic terrorism, a debate that mirrors many of the country's divisions. The Trump years saw a dramatic unraveling of norms. Far-right elements, once considered fringe or extreme, suddenly seem to have the embrace of the presidency. Many of those forces seem to converge on January 6th with the storming of the U.S. Capitol. It was an event senior law enforcement would come to label as a clear act of domestic terror.
We're seeing a little bit more of a shift, I think, among the population about what we do think of as terrorism.
Mary McCord is a former acting attorney general for national security at the Department of Justice. She says as we recalibrate the definition of domestic terrorism, it's hard to equate torching an empty building with the deadly hate crimes of recent years. Instances like mass shootings at a Walmart in El Paso and a synagogue in Pittsburgh
that are clearly aimed at people to kill people and to make other people in fear of being killed so that they will feel intimidated and coerced and push government policy into an anti-immigrant, anti-Semitic, anti-people of color policies.
McCord says the most deadly concern is far-right white supremacists. In fact, FBI Director Christopher Wray said as much in March while testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee.
We elevated racially and ethnically motivated violent extremism to our highest threat priority, on the same level with ISIS and homegrown violent extremists, where it remains to this day.
So where does that leave the case of Joseph Deeby? Federal authorities still consider him a domestic terrorist, despite his case falling outside the country's most urgent threats. Just before Deeby was indicted in 2006, he fled the country. FBI wanted posters offered a $50,000 reward and noted Deeby should be considered armed and dangerous. For 12 years, he evaded capture, living mostly in Syria and Russia before he was arrested in 2018 while traveling through Cuba.
I'm not saying he couldn't be convicted. He, of course, can be.
Matt Schindler is Deeby's attorney. He says calling Joseph Deeby a domestic terrorist goes too far.
When we apply this label terrorism, it's almost as though we're saying to the government, okay, you have carte blanche to use every asset and every resource and endless amounts of money without any real critical thought applied to that decision.
In January, after more than 2 years in pretrial custody, Deeby was released from a Portland jail. He now lives with family in Seattle and wears a GPS ankle bracelet. If convicted, the federal charges he faces could mean decades in prison. It's made him reflective about events from, as he puts it, 3 lifetimes ago.
There's certainly people change over time.
Though what hasn't changed for him is a desire to protect the environment. And without elaborating, Deeby acknowledged that today he wouldn't employ some of the same methods.
I feel like a lot of it back then was quite confrontational and probably not very productive.
Meanwhile, Deeby's lawyer says the case isn't a priority for the government like it once was. In fact, the federal prosecutor assigned to it for the last several years has been moved. That prosecutor is now working on cases from the January 6th riot. For NPR News, I'm Conrad Wilson in Portland.
I'm still reeling from Nathan Allen's murderous actions, a rampage which began when he stole a white box truck, hit a car, crashed into a house, and jumped off the wrecked vehicle with two guns blazing. Somehow, I thought it would be a relief to know that the 28-year-old Winthrop resident had no accomplices in fatally gunning down David Green and Ramona Cooper, who also lived in Winthrop. Though he appeared to shoot randomly whoever was in his path, in fact, he deliberately bypassed whites, instead targeting African Americans, retired Massachusetts State Police Trooper Green, and Air Force veteran Cooper. Police shot and killed Allen, ending his brief killing spree. Looking for evidence to explain his motivation, police found Allen's handwritten racist and anti-Semitic screeds. Hours after the tragic event, Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins declared that Nathan Allen had hate in his heart. I've been turning this story over in my mind, wondering how long the apparent white supremacist had carried hate in his heart, and more, why he decided to act on it now. A question all the more puzzling, since he didn't seem to fit the stereotype of a loner with a lack of social skills and not much education. Somebody like Dylan Roof, who repeated the ninth grade and was unemployed when he gunned down nine people in Charleston's Emmanuel Church. By contrast, Nathan Allen had earned a Ph.D., was newly married, and had no police record. Last year, Boston Globe columnist Thomas Farragher profiled him and his then-girlfriend in a sweet story about his surprising her with a very special proposal. It happened shortly after she got home after attending a rally for Bernie Sanders, the uber-liberal Jewish senator. I would have to assume, given the views he wrote about shortly before the day of his killings, the Nathan Allen she knew last year when they married was somebody other than this rage-fueled killer. It would make sense that if he did do a 180 from the time of the wedding, he would have been influenced by or become a member of one of the many white supremacist groups on the rise. The ones FBI Director Christopher Wray told the Senate Judiciary Committee in March now make up the majority of the department's investigations. Wray was there to testify about the groups who violently stormed the Capitol on January 6th, groups whose members he described as domestic terrorists. He added, racially motivated violent extremism, especially of the sort that advocates for the superiority of the white race, is a persistent, evolving threat. Members of those groups are openly espousing their hate as a mission statement and recruiting tool. But the police say they are confident that Allen self-radicalized and had not joined any organization. I imagine him studying from an online curriculum of hate rhetoric, and I'm reminded of the lyrics of a serious song from the otherwise frothy musical South Pacific. You've got to be taught to hate and fear. You've got to be taught from year to year. What scares me is even if he acted alone in this shocking incident, his actions suggest many more like him are just one opportunistic circumstance away from turning their private hate into a public attack. Belmont resident Henry Tapia's friends and family are still grieving his loss. In January, Tapia, who is black, exchanged sharp words with Dean Capsulis, who is white, in a road rage incident that ended when Capsulis allegedly called him the N-word and then ran over Tapia, killing him. Capsulis, who left the scene of the crime and later turned himself in, has been charged with murder and assault and battery, with an additional charge for leaving the scene. The family has filed a civil lawsuit, and a small group of protesters has kept his name and case in the public eye. I see these seemingly isolated incidents linked together in what the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. called the chain of evil of hate begetting hate. Two good people are gone because of one man's link in that chain. Two good people who woke up on that Saturday not knowing they wouldn't live another day. When will we understand that the virulence of racism is an infection that spreads like COVID-19 and is just as deadly, and that no one is immune? Callie Crossley, GBH, Boston's local NPR.
Yo, 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 once upon a time up in Jersey, yo, ha ha, We turn our attention now to a disgusting display that led to charges being filed against one South Jersey man and brought a community together in protest.
A large one, in fact. Yeah. It all started with the video showing the 45-year-old Mount Laurel resident screaming racist slurs and threatening his neighbors on Friday. And the now viral clip, he called for people to show up at his home, and that is exactly what has happened.
Action News reporter George Solis live in that neighborhood with this developing story. George, let us know what you're learning about this.
Yeah, Gray and Sarah, this has been a very active scene here all morning and afternoon. Protesters have been growing by the hour. Many of them prepared to stay for the long haul. Many of them prepared with signs, many of them with chairs. Take a look behind me. You can see some of the activity here as they have staged outside of this man's home. This crowd has grown exponentially, especially as more people have watched this already viral video. Now, things have been peaceful, but there have been a few tense moments. Tensions and tempers flared Monday on Gramercy Way in Mount Laurel, New Jersey. The anger and outrage centered on this.
Back up. Go up close.
Back up. Keep
go
backing
close.
Up.
Back up.
Go touch.
Keep backing up.
Go touch me. Go touch me.
An explosive interaction between neighbors caught on video back on July 2nd is now part of a police investigation.
Walk away. It's not Africa.
Oh, this is Africa.
It's not Solomon or wherever you were.
I was born in America.
Well, then you know what common ground. What's common ground?
I don't give a shit about you.
According to police, the man in the video in the green shirt is 45-year-old Edward Cagney Matthews.
This over here, both have videotape of you putting your hands on me.
Matthews now faces harassment and bias intimidation charges connected to the dispute that, according to neighbors, stem from months of issues with the development's HOA board, including this racial slur written on a board member's fence and years of allegations of harassment of others. Allegations Matthew appeared to address in the video as he uses slur after racial slur.
And you want to know where I was when all this happened?
I don't care.
At work, monkey.
I don't care where you were.
At morque. Just like I told the Mount Laurel police.
The tirade continued, even as an officer showed up.
You know what? Hold on. No. I'm going to let you do your thing. Go talk to these.
Before the video ends, Matthew gave out his home address, seemingly encouraging protesters who arrived on cue. Matthews later came out to address the crowd, only to be ushered back inside his home.
We're not just going to let him harass people, especially black people. Within this community or any community.
Jasmine Szczynski and her mother, Aaliyah Robinson, showed up to protest and claimed they, too, were victimized by Matthews in years past.
We have tried to get justice. And if we got justice, this wouldn't be happening now.
And again, a live look at the scene here in Mount Laurel, New Jersey. Again, protesters coming in and out. This crowd only growing larger by the moment, it seems. Mount Laurel police said Matthews faces harassment and bias intimidation charges. It's unknown at this point if he's under investigation for any prior allegation. Now, the agency did put out a statement along with the information this afternoon saying they do not condone any of the behavior seen in that video. We are live in Mount Laurel, New Jersey. George Solis, Channel 6. Action News. Back to you.
All right, George, we'll stay on that for sure.
So, you know, these events that keep coming up, instead of just reacting, dealing with them one at a time and being shocked each time we have another event that surfaces that is brought to our attention, we need to function from the position of an analysis that clarifies we are in a total system structure of racism, white supremacy, and that is why we are seeing the kinds of behaviors from individuals, be it Donald Sterling or be it George Zimmerman or any of the other cases that come to our attention. There is a reason that these cases exist. And I want to also talk about, in this case, they talked about mental health, but also gun control. And we have to begin to understand, I say you can't understand the gun mania if you don't understand racism, white supremacy. The gun is the answer to conscious and or subconscious. The answer, the response to the quite collective feeling they can be genetically annihilated by black genetic material. And the gun is a great equalizer. I encourage everybody to get a copy of the ISIS papers and read.
Over the July 4th holiday weekend in the US, at least 150 people were killed in gun violence. 50 people died in shooting incidents in the state of New York alone. Now its governor, Andrew Cuomo, has declared a state of emergency.
It's so bad that
when you look at the recent numbers, more people are dying of gun violence than of COVID. It is an emergency. And I want the people of the state to understand that. So today, first state in the nation is going to declare a disaster emergency on gun violence.
Our U.S. correspondent David Willis told me more about what was happening in New York State.
Well, this disaster emergency order, Oliver, is first of its kind in the country, and it enables the state of New York to quickly allocate money and resources to areas where gun violence is at its worst. Among Governor Cuomo's plans are the creation of an Office of Gun Violence Prevention, intended to pinpoint where resources are most needed, the creation of a department to track the illegal flow of guns from other states, and job training programs for youngsters in poorer parts of the state in order to basically keep them off the streets. Governor Cuomo has called this an epidemic. And as you mentioned, he said more people are now dying from crime and gun violence in New York than are dying from COVID-19.
Yeah. And do we know why that is?
Well, he said that much of it was caused by the pandemic, keeping people out of work, out of school, without anything productive to do during the day. There are a number of factors that are thought to be at play here. Crime historically rises in this country during the summer. And of course, this year it's expected to that rise to be even more pronounced than usual. But the variety of factors, as I mentioned, initially, crime rates actually fell during the pandemic as people were cooped up inside. But then unemployment resulting from it is thought to have played a part in the increase in this violence, along with the proliferation, of course, of firearms and questions over police legitimacy in the wake of the George Floyd killing. And in Chicago, for example, where there's been a very sharp spike in gun crime, the police, for example, are blaming a scheme under which people charged with murder are released back temporarily into the community. So a variety of factors thought to be at play here.
Yeah, this spike seen across the country, might we see these kind of measures elsewhere?
It's a good question, and we might well. I mean, gun violence in New York has surged along with that of other parts of the United States. 51 people killed in shooting incidents over the 4th of July holiday there in New York. 100 people shot in Chicago over the weekend as well, at least a dozen of them children or thought to be children. So, yes, there is a real dire need in other parts of the country, apart from New York, for some sort of measures to tackle this.
David Willis talking to me from Washington.
Well, Haiti is on the list of what's supposed to be. Haiti, the people who are called Haitians, predominantly are people who are classified as non-white. So they're not supposed to ever have anything under the system of white supremacy except punishment
yeah.
for being arrogant enough under Toussaint to think that you, with your military skills, can take us over or tell us what to do. So many a historian has said that the reason Haiti is in the shape that it's in now, and sort of like the head wagon people of the world, you might say,
mm-hmm.
everybody kind of looks on them with great pity. It's because the white supremacists made that decision.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to make examples of you. Don't you ever think that you can have military force against me, us white supremacists of the world. And we're going to make a perennial example of you up until the point we decide that we're not going to make that example. But you're going to be in poverty. You're going to be pitiful. You're going to be beggars of the first order. You're going to be dislocated trying to find a place to go because you can't stand being where you are, because I'm going to see to it that where you are will never be anything.
The country of Haiti is under a state of emergency tonight after President Jovenel Moise was assassinated early this morning. He had been in office for 4 years. His wife, Martine, was wounded in the brazen attack at their home on the outskirts of the capital, Port-au-Prince. Tonight, she has been airlifted to Miami for treatment. Yamiche Alcindor begins our coverage.
Haiti's president assassinated, the island nation in a state of shock.
We live in this area close to the president. Even when we have problems with him, we can't imagine that they would kill him like this.
Hours after President Jovenel Moïse was murdered in his own home, the streets of Port-au-Prince were uncharacteristically quiet. Outside the president's private residence and the scene of the crime lay bullet casings. Haiti's first lady, Martine Moïse, was wounded in the attack and remains hospitalized. In a video reportedly shot at the scene, someone says the assassins are with the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration. But Haitian ambassador to the U.S., Bochit Edmond, said the DEA was not involved. Instead, he blamed mercenaries who spoke English and Spanish.
It seems that this horrible act was carried out by well-trained professional killers, commandos.
The Haitian government closed the airport in Port-au-Prince, so Edmond said the assassins likely escaped by land into the neighboring Dominican Republic or by sea. President Biden said the United States was ready to assist in the aftermath of the shooting. He responded to my question on the situation on the White House lawn.
What's your reaction, Mr. President, to the Haitian president being assassinated?
We need a lot more information, but it's very worrisome about the state of Haiti.
Moïse was a polarizing president. In the last few months, his actions sparked massive protests around the country. During his term, gang violence and kidnappings skyrocketed. UNICEF reported that armed gangs control about a third of Port-au-Prince. And since the violence spiked last September, more than 18,000 people have fled their homes. Moïse was elected in 2016, but didn't take office until the following year. He said his five-year term was supposed to end in 2022. But his critics, including human rights groups and clergy members, insisted that his term was up this past February. Earlier this year, he dissolved parliament, saying most lawmakers' terms had ended. He also forced three Supreme Court justices into early retirement. Moïse pursued sweeping constitutional changes that would increase presidential power. He planned to vote on a referendum, as well as his replacement in September. That election is in flux. The United States backed Moïse's timeline, but U.S. officials also criticized what they called his unchecked presidential power.
This situation calls into question the core precepts of Haiti's democracy.
But Haitian human rights activists like Pierre Esperance opposed the U.S. backing Moïse, as Esperance told us in March.
The people of Haiti and the Haitian community in the United States are very disappointed by the Biden administration's politics.
Now interim Prime Minister Claude Joseph is the country's de facto leader. Earlier today, Joseph called into a news program.
I call for calm of the population. The situation of the country is already under control.
Moïse named Joseph his sixth prime minister in April. But Moïse had intended for a seventh, Ariel Henry, to replace him. He was supposed to be sworn in today.
For more on the assassination of President Moïse and the shockwave that it sent through Haiti, I'm joined by Wolbert Faton. He's a professor of government and foreign affairs at the University of Virginia. He has written extensively on Haiti throughout the years. He joins me from Charlottesville, Virginia. Professor Faton, thank you so much for being here. Haiti has really been in a constitutional crisis for several months now. People on the ground say it's hit a new rock bottom. But talk about the gravity of the last 24 hours and the difference now that the president has been murdered.
Well, this is a shocking event in the history of Haiti. The last assassination of a president was in 1915. So this is not the usual pattern at all. We've had coups, we've had attempted coups, we've had obviously very nasty dictators who've killed a lot of people. But that, especially given that it was, as far as we know, an armed attack by foreign mercenaries, it's really a different pattern. And it's difficult to understand why that would have happened and who would benefit from it. It is really something that is out of the ordinary. It's truly an extraordinary event. So we are facing a de facto government. The government that has taken charge, has instituted, as you probably know, a state of siege, which is really the ultimate type of governmental imposition of order. But it remains to be seen if that state of siege can keep the country without significant disorder and a descent into chaos.
And how concerned are you about Haiti hitting an even lower rock bottom and gangs possibly trying to benefit from this situation?
This is a very dangerous moment for Haiti. My personal hope is that what we will get is a government of national unity that could take over and set a situation whereby elections would be possible, not immediately, but probably next year, and where there would be some sort of reconciliation between all of the different Haitian actors. Now, whether we can get there is the big question. The opposition has shown no inclination to really join with the government of Jovenel Moïse, but Jovenel Moïse, as president, is gone. So in a paradoxical way, in a tragic way, this might be an opening for such a compromise. Mm-hmm. But we will have to see. And we will have to see also whether the current prime minister is, in fact, going to remain in that position.
There have been a lot of Haitians who have been disappointed in the stance of the Biden administration toward Haiti. What role do you see the U.S. potentially playing now after this assassination?
Well, personally, I think that the most important thing is to try to get a Haitian solution. So if the Biden administration is to have a constructive approach to Haiti, I think they should push the government to really create the conditions for a government of national unity. Now, how do you form that government of national unity is a big question. It may well be that the government of national unity would require not only the current members of the, or some of the current members of the government and some of the members of the opposition, but also civil society leaders who are above the traditional politics that has been rather disastrous for the country. So a solution like that might, in fact, bring some hope to the population. But if you don't have that, I'm afraid that we might be descending into chaos, and that might in turn open the gates for another UN intervention, and we are back to where we were in 2004.
And with only a few seconds left here, there are only 10 elected officials left in Haiti. They're all senators. There are a lot of civil society leaders who want to see that transitional government that you've been talking about. Is there a constitutional solution here? And who benefited from this situation with the president now gone?
Yeah, we are beyond the constitutional crisis. The constitution now has been ignored, essentially, because we don't have a president, we don't have a functioning parliament, we don't have a Supreme Court justice that is functioning. So the institutions have decayed. So what is needed is really imagination on how to constitute an order that could appease all of the forces in Haiti. And that's a very difficult process and difficult to imagine given what we've had in the past where the polarization was indeed very extreme.
A difficult road ahead for Haiti. Thank you so much, Professor Faton of the University of Virginia, for joining us.
Thank you so much.
As more facts are emerging about the assassination of the Haitian president, Jovenel Moïse, so many more unanswered questions still remain to be resolved. As we record this podcast, we now know that 17 members of the team which carried out the killing have been captured and paraded before the press. Most are former members of the Colombian military. But the island's chief of police, Leon Charles, told the world that they still want to find out who those behind it were.
We already have the physical perpetrators in hand, and we're looking for the intellectual perpetrators. It's the job of the police to bring the accomplices to justice so that the presidential family and the country find justice.
BBC News Online's Latin America and Caribbean editor Vanessa Bushlukta gave me more details.
What I'm going to do is hit you with a couple of numbers here. So what we know is that there are 28 suspects in total. Eight of those are still on the run, so the police are still searching for eight men who are on the loose in Haiti. 17, as you said in your introduction, have been apprehended, and 15 of those are Colombians. The two remaining ones are US citizens of Haitian descent. Three of the suspects were killed. Yesterday, the chief of police had said it was four, but it was three, so we've got that updated number.
And what about these questions about the nationalities of those involved? Is Colombia involved in trying to help find out more?
Absolutely. The Colombian Defense Minister, Diego Molano, has confirmed that his ministry received an official request for information and that he's complying with that. He said that six of the Colombian nationals were former soldiers, and he didn't comment on the remaining ones just because he didn't get officially asked about them. Now, they are ex-members of the army, so there doesn't seem to be a link to any current members of the military.
And are there questions about the protection that the president had? Because it does seem incredible that a group of men could just come in and do this.
Yes, of course, the president had bodyguards, and two of those bodyguards are being questioned by the police. So the officials in Haiti want to know whether there may have been a possible involvement. Now, what we have seen in videos which haven't been verified independently is that these assailants arrived in a number of SUVs, and they seemed to pretend that they were Drug Enforcement Administration agents, so US drug agents, but Haitian officials have stressed that they were just disguising themselves as such. It's not like they were really US agents, but that's how they broke into the house and how this heinous murder happened.
Vanessa Bushluchter, the Latin America and Caribbean editor for BBC Online.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, or July 10, Saturday, 2021. So I have been told. Hopefully everyone made it safely through the July 4th foolishness. I know that's last weekend, or actually that was Sunday, so technically that would be in the last 7 days or so for this broadcast, the compensatory call-in. Man, I saw so many reports of, they had, was an NHL hockey player, professional hockey player, who was killed. Fireworks went awry. They had workers, city workers presumably, who were out trying to prepare for the ensuing fireworks display, and somehow one of the explosives ignited, and they had, you know, smoke and fire, and they had to call off the fireworks show, and it was tons of those type of events in addition to all the shootings that they talked about. But hopefully we survived it all. Alcohol and explosives is always a horrendous combination. Nothing to celebrate at all. Again, compensatory call in, the number 720-716-7300, the code 564-943, pound, press star 61 if you would like to participate. The number again, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943, pound, press star 61 if you would like to participate. We had lots of clips this week. There were lots of things that happened because it was kind of surprising, because this was technically a holiday week. The mail didn't even run on Monday, but wow, lots of things happened all over the world. The assassination down in Haiti, President Jovenel Moise, and all those ramifications. Even the report allegation that there were DEA agents present and may have been involved. Usual suspects, my goodness. Again, we have had individuals come on this very platform who said, man, that is hogwash. Sit around reading the news, checking the news, watching the news. It's all lies. It's foolishness. What are you doing that for? It's a waste of time. I don't check no news source about nothing. That is totally ignorant. Check the news. Yes, there are lots of lies, but you won't know what those lies and deceptions are if you don't check the news. Also, my quick study, if we have any listeners out there, let's just see. Did anybody know about Nathan Allen, 28-year-old white terrorist in Massachusetts? Is this the first time that people heard the name Nathan Allen? Because I didn't know about this fella until I heard Callie Crawley's report. I normally play her segments, Black Female Journalist. I appreciate what she does, WGBH in Boston. But I didn't know anything about this fella, Nathan Allen. So we're in the Me Too 21st, almost 2022. all this technology and what have you, sit around and shake our finger at Bill Cosby and run all this. This fellow went and killed two black people. Matter of fact, let me read a little bit. And then you all can tell me. Had you heard about Nathan Allen? Is this the first time you're hearing about him? So, hate-filled writings of accused Winthrop gunman Nathan Allen released by district attorney. As investigators continue to piece together a deadly double shooting in Winthrop last month, the Suffolk County District Attorney's Office released some writings from the alleged shooter, Nathan Allen. Massachusetts State Police said Allen had frequently read extremist literature over the past several months and recovered many of Allen's journals from his apartment. According to investigators, in one notebook, Allen wrote, "White people are the world's apex predators. Whites in the USA are waking up. Fact." All caps underlined. "The white race is superior." In another notebook, investigators said Allen wrote, "Men, presumably white, need to kill things. Women, presumably white, do not understand men." I could easily see this being another one. They say, "Oh my gosh, the patriarchy," and or maybe not, because I suspect a lot of people haven't heard about this fella at all. Continues, investigators said the entry was dated June 24, 2021, less than 48 hours before Allen allegedly shot and killed retired Massachusetts State Police Trooper David Green, black male, and Air Force veteran Ramona Cooper, black female. On the last page of the Allen Diaries, pause, the Cows Book Club, we read the Turner Diaries way, way back. That's one of the first books that we read, in fact, on the Cows Book Club. They say one of the most influential books written in the last half century in this part of the world. Dr. William Pierce, the Turner Diaries. So this is the Allen Diaries. Investigators said he ended with, "Jesus Christ, I hate." I bet this was the N-word. See, that's why I don't like all that redacting. Just put down what he said, man. Nothing is more offensive than going out and killing black people. Just put out what he said. Then I don't have to guess. Now, did he say Negro or did he say something? "Jesus Christ, I hate something. I hope I can turn Audrey to the truth or her to me. But I doubt it." I bet that's the F word. "When will it all pop off?" And I'll stop there. They give more information. We had talked about reading some of these diaries, journals, if you will. This is one I would like to see the full journal, because they said this fella had a PhD and just got married, 28 years old, not an old white guy and all that. No criminal record. What in the world? Let's see the full unredacted journal. And again, did you all know about this guy? Nathan Allen goes out and kills two black people, dies in a gun battle. Do you all know about this? Or no, you just heard about the, the Moors, the rise of the Moors, the arrest from last week. We heard about that one, but we didn't hear about Nathan Allen. That's what I bet. We'll see, maybe. I played the segment on the Boy Scouts just because racism, white supremacy, the sexual abuse is rampant, even of children. What does that fool say? White people don't care about children. Yes. Another one that I'd say, man, they spent all that time whining about Bill Cosby. This is like generations of child rape. Next, the segment on Cancer Alley. They want to put this grain facility in down in southern Louisiana, Mississippi area. They got this black town. They say, man, we've come to the Mississippi River and hung out all these years, and this is just going to be more pollution down in Cancer Alley, which is in Louisiana technically, but same region. And they had Lawrence Alexis on, and he said he didn't want, you know, this facility here. He didn't think it was good for the people. And they said, oh, he's speaking in his thick accent. And I said, no, it doesn't sound like he's speaking in a thick accent. It sounds like he has some respiratory issues that have impacted his voice. It almost sounded like he was wheezing as he was talking. I was like, this is not an accent issue. This is an, what do they call, environmental racism, environmental terrorism issue. He's talking about all the different colors of dust that they have, red dust, poison, call it what it is. We got red poison, we got black poison, we got green poison, we got white poison, call it what it is. This sounds like it had some sort of corrosive impact on his vocal cords, his ability to speak. Unless I've been confused. But I didn't think it was just as, oh, yeah, we got these niggers in there. You know, strange colloquial Negro dialect. Like, get out of here. Let's see. So they had the segment NPR on in Stockton, California, where young Joe Green, 16 years old, black male, gets shot by this white officer Johnson, and nothing's done about it. And then Officer Johnson goes on to kill some more black males in his time on the force. I said, one, NPR is so lame. The element of white supremacy, racism, why the man not, Dr. Tommy J. Curry's book is in my top 10. We had Dr. T. Hassan Johnson on. Black misandry is such a crucial component of how white supremacy racism operates. I just said yesterday they had that whole segment on NPR talking about the Crown Act and racism with regards to black people and hair in the workplace. Yes, that's a huge deal, but they totally ignored how this impacts black males. I just said we had a former LAPD officer on the program just this week, and he said, man, my being hired full-time was delayed because it all said, man, you got to shave, and you got those razor bumps, and oh my goodness, and that's not professional, and you got to shave, and how that ends up being a huge problem for lots of black males, and locks, cornrows, lots of different components of shaving, lip beards, retired firefighter. For black males, how are they totally excluded from this report? That was one. And then you come back the next day, so you got the report, Joe Green, black male, gets killed, and then Officer Johnson, he kills another black male. You got all this information about the disproportionate amount of force against black people, and it's not disproportionate force against black people. Every bit of data I've seen in the world about police force, it is disproportionate against black males. If you can be lopsided and just focus on black females for the hair component yesterday, which is incorrect, but whatever, when you come back for the point where you're just saying black male names over and over and over, this is disproportionately impacting black males. It seems to be this way of racism, white supremacy operates, and you can't even do that. Black misandry, core component of how white supremacy racism operates. And even with NPR, they were so lame. I said it last week. They had that segment with Michelle Martin where they were talking about carjackings. They want to talk about all the gun violence. They bring on a black male. They couldn't just bring on a black male carjacker. No, no, no. We got to bring on a black male rapist carjacker. And then we'll take up half the discussion talking about him being a rapist and who he raped and what was in your mind when you went to go do some raping, black male. Nathan Allen. White man, 28. Oh, and then Joe Green, even in this week, wait a minute, I didn't get finished. So the segment where they talk about Joe Green, who is 16, not an adult, that's black misandry too. You can't even be a black boy. No, 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 no. You're a grisly potential rapist, mugger, 40-year-old assassin. I'm just 16. I just went to... Said he went to get gummy worms. So we get the report on 16-year-old Joe Green, and they say Officer Johnson went on to be involved in two police shootings, and in one of those, he killed a black man who was accused of domestic violence. See, even there, like, you want to go, oh, man, they killed a black man who's accused of domestic violence. Oh, then never mind. No count. Nigra male. They hate the nigra male. Ugh, he's always raping and abusing and stealing and got his pants. Yeah, yeah. Let's see. Before we get to the number, we heard the segment on Sha'Carri Johnson. Outkast said it way better than I could. Much obliged. Andre 3000, big boy. That's what I thought. Like, for real, that's what I thought when I first heard about that story. Like, anybody at this point in time, if you're going to be an Olympic athlete, you know you're going to be drug tested. All of that said, what does that idiot say? He says, listen, what is he says? White people don't care about children. That's one that idiot says. What's the one the other one? He says, sobriety would be best. That's what he says. Idiot. Let's see. We heard retired firefighter two times in the segment he was talking about, previously mentioned, Sha'Carri Richardson. I think he said the same thing I did. Then we heard him. He was talking about the rise of the Moors. I don't know if any of their affiliates were listening, but ooh-wee, if they were, I'm sure that, man,
brother firefighter, there was not a shootout. We did not fire around. Like, see there? You're going to get our goose cooked metaphor. It was an armed standoff. There is a major difference between shootout and armed standoff. I suspect if there had been a shootout, we'd have been hearing about bodies in the street and not a trial pending and whether or not these niggers are going to cooperate through the court proceedings. But yes, words are important. And that's just something I've said consistently. When those initial reports come out, be very careful because a lot of times they are not accurate. It may have even been reported that there was a shootout just because Negros were involved. So it could have been in some of the initial reports that there was a shootout. And that is not the case. But strive for accuracy. And we end up with a lot of those Joe Greens where it's always a black person is, you know, shooting and much more aggressive than they actually were when they didn't actually fire around at all. Saying, hey, we are law-abiding constitutional gun owners. Second Amendment, right? That's what they said in the audio segment. Number is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If you could take about 5 minutes to share your thoughts, observations, suggestions, that would be grand. If you know you're in a noisy environment, if you could use your mute button, that would be super helpful, just so we don't have to compete with unnecessary noise. And if we could avoid metaphors for the broadcast, race soldiers will use lots of metaphors to confound and practice deception. We've been exposed to this misconduct for a long time. If we could try to be direct with our commentary, precise, that would be appreciated. I will prompt about the metaphors. *61 if you have commentary, thoughts, observations to share. Again, we had the clips were a little long this week, but lots of things happened, and then the assassination too. I thought, how could we leave out an assassination of a individual classified as black president? How could we leave that out? Yeah, so we'll have to make do. Let's see. Folks who dialed in, if you have commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed. Folks are taking a moment to gather their thoughts. There should be lots of things either personally or otherwise to share a thought observation. Incidentally, as we're kind of getting settled in, we have to check Black Talk Radio Network to see about programs for the upcoming week. Trying to see if we can have some white and non-white people to hang out. Hopefully one on diet, eating correctly. That would be beneficial. And then some white people as well. But just check Black Talk Radio Network Facebook for updates, broadcast for the coming week or so. Try to get through the summer in the most constructive manner possible. Let's see. Folks still spectating, getting their thoughts together. Here, folks. See, some people, I don't know, they had a hand up, but then they didn't have a question. Maybe they're trying to relocate or make sure they're properly situated. We'll give them some time or so to get their thoughts together. The situation in Haiti, that would certainly be one I would encourage folks to kind of be mindful. I'm sure many folks, they may not necessarily check the news on what's happening in Haiti on a daily basis, maybe not even on a weekly or monthly basis. That's one of the reasons we try to have the Global Sunday Talk, so that we can kind of be checking out and aware, thinking of white supremacy, racism as a global problem and trying as best we can to try to look and pay attention to things that are happening in other parts of the globe. But I certainly think that is important, something we should be paying attention to. That'll something that'll be probably a major issue for the rest of the year. I mean, if they're going to have elections now and all that and investigations, like, certainly something to be mindful about. I also, the vaccine piece, that was at the beginning. There were lots of reports, but they had we had the one report talking about vaccine rates in the Chicago area. They were talking about in areas where it's lots of black people, lower vaccine rates, areas where it's predominantly white, high vaccine rates, not, you know, very many case numbers. Things are almost back to the way it was before all of this started. That, and then in conjunction with what they said about things on the continent and how it's looking like they're not going to have vaccines, not in any substantive manner or volume anytime soon. I have said the same thing. Man, the micro and the macro are congruent, where they're black people not having the same type of access to this vaccine as white people. And that, 5 years down the road, could end up having a huge impact in how all of this evolves over the next years. Way I'm thinking next few years or so. But I mean, what? It has been that for about a year, where they've said, not just here in the U.S., but in the world, black people, and it's not even just black people, non-white people in general, very slow access or no access at all to the vaccine. White people much higher and getting back to their way of life and having fun, grand old times, enjoying their summer. Something to be mindful about, in my opinion, moving forward. Let's see. Folks still getting their thoughts together or have thoughts to share. Let's see.
May I be heard?
Caller in Florida. Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners, and callers. I wanted to start out with the, it looks like they were talking about some kind of medication, I guess. They were talking about obesity. I just think, in my view, I don't know, that sounds like a major idea, but I don't know how that would end up working out with, because it sounded like about the insurance issues and how much that would cost for people to be able to start using that. But I just would prefer, I guess, just diet and exercise. But given the issue of how, I think they said it was 100 million people, as they say, struggle with obesity, but just the side effects that, you know, that could come about when someone can start taking such medication, because just with medication in general, like when I look at those advertisements and the extensive list of just the side effects that they mentioned, it's definitely critical to your body and your system. So there's just no telling just on that part alone. The other segment where they were talking about the suspected racist, or I guess I would say white supremacists, I did see that video where the guy was saying the word nigger. But my thing is, it's interesting how it takes that direct, or always that form of white supremacy being practiced. Oh, well, hey, they have to use some kind of a racial slur. See, then you have a whole bunch of black people, white people mixed in, congregating on this person's property, and people throwing food at him. And he still had race soldiers, I think. He had race soldiers
helping to move him. I don't know if he was being taken somewhere or something. So he still was being protected by white supremacy in some way. But you just never know. It could be racist white supremacists right there in that crowd. So I think they could use stories like that to deceive the victims of racism, because they, well, white people tend to only not give a response. I guess if you try to say that someone's practicing racism, well, I was called this, I was called that. And even then, they'll still, white people who use what they call racial slurs, you know, or that they'll flip it. Well, hey, I was repeating something on a rap song or something. They have all kinds of pre-rehearsed racist code, right? So I think it was another scene where, like, I noticed that they'll use the far right when they talk about white people. It looks like a lot of white men a lot of the times do these militias or have these militias. Like when they, I think they attempted to kidnap the governor, right, up in Michigan, I think. They still use the term right, and that word right is used like when something's right, the right direction, or when something's correct, something's good, something's right, and then it rhymes with white. So, you know, they have white is right, and I think that's it has some underlying connotations, I think, with how they use that term when they describe white supremacist groups, because someone who's racist can be so-called Democrat, so-called Republican. And I just wanted to point that out. And I did hear about the Nathan Allen. And one last thing is that they would not show his image when I saw that report. So I couldn't really get the gist of those writings and everything. So that was interesting, what he wrote. And it did remind me of Dylan Storm Roof. And that's all I had to share. Thanks for allowing me to speak.
Yeah, definitely some Dylan Storm Roof overtones, the manifesto and the rallying call metaphor to the white race, seeming like he's speaking specifically to other race soldiers and saying that they're waking up, they're getting it, they're understanding what is happening. That's interesting that they didn't have his picture there. I think I did see one report and they had a picture of him. Again, this is a 28-year-old Nathan Allen, 28-year-old white man, not some crusty old Paula Deen, Donald Trump, Donald Sterling type that they like to say, 28 years old with a PhD, not toothless and, you know, on welfare and Appalachian, not PhD, married, no criminal record. And the Allen diary, sounding as though he had read the Turner diaries. Let's see, that obesity drug, like, I agree 1,000%. I'm not even intelligent enough to pronounce it accurately, what the name of it is. It's semaglutide, I think is how you say it, semaglutide. But I, like, agree 1,000%. Exercise, drink your water, not eating all kinds of crazy food and ice cream and Cheetos and potato chips. And that I started that segment with the Fat Boys obesogenic environment. $3.99, all you can eat. That's what we got. We're going to have donut day at work every day and all the rest of it. Like that sort of environment, you'll have all of us on this medication that I cannot pronounce, provided that the insurers will cover it. I don't think that's the best way. I think the best way is to just eat better foods, not too much of it, drink water, get some exercise. Could do wonders. get away from those non-water beverages. And I look at anything, even if it's not medications, but I mean medication, I'm at, unless there's like some like medical condition where this is the best route, like you know, it's drastic situation, drastic measures are called for, unless it's that type of a thing, like, no, let's change your diet. Let's do it the healthy way. I'm suspicious of anything because they said in that report, one of the ladies, she got the medication and then she had to go off of it and she started gaining some of the weight back. And I said, see, that's, in my opinion, I see that throughout, whether it's these, you know, goofy fad diets, the medication, whatever it is, you do whatever this is. You lose the weight, and then as soon as you go back to just a regular diet, you eat a banana or whatever a regular normal food is, you're not on this medication or eating these special foods, and then you gain all the weight back. A sustainable way where you are, for your life, you are committed, you eat a healthy amount of plant-based foods, not too much, drink lots of water, you get some exercise for your size, for your body type, for your activity. I know the correct amount of food to eat and the types of food to eat. If you're eating on a regular basis, fruits, vegetables, nuts, some whole grains, not tons of it. You're not eating ice cream and cookies and potato chips and all kinds of goofy processed foods. I don't think you're going to have like extraordinary weight problems and, you know, going to have to be looking for all of these really drastic remedies to the problem. And again, I can't say it enough, man, talk about drug. This one drug here that I can't pronounce, Semaglutide or whatever it is, man, you want to talk about drugs? All of the additives that they put in the foods, those Cheetos and Pringles and the other nonsense that we eat, stuff that to preserve it or to give it those addictive qualities, so we have to go back and eat 50,000 of them. That is a big part of it too. Because they talked about with that drug, they said it would change certain signals to your brain about when you're hungry and the types of food that you want to eat. A lot of that has been chemically altered when you eat all that nonsense that have food colorings and dyes and all the rest of it in it, high fructose corn syrup. That sends a lot of incorrect messaging to your brain, lots of addictive qualities. So just leaving all of that stuff like permanently alone can do wonders for your health, diet, all the rest. So I totally agree. No medications, eat well. What you put on your plate, that right there is counter-racism. We certainly do not want to trade Cheetos for whatever this medication is. That's not an improvement. What is it? Solving problems without creating new problems. I don't want it to be my problem is that I'm overweight because I eat too many bad food. Now my problem is I got to get this medication, make sure my insurer covers it. Not a good trade. Much obliged, caller in Florida. Let's see. Other folks, comments they want to make sure they get in. Folks spectating. Saw other folks with hands up, but they did their confused where they get their hands up and then either they don't say anything or they'll just have noise in the background. Sometimes I don't know if they're trying to get to a quiet environment or they're just horsing around on the phone, but we'll give them a moment. If folks are just spectating, I feel like this is one of those weeks where this should not be spectating, should be lots of things to process, try to make sense of, should not just be spectating. This is also one of those weeks, which is why it's not just about entertainment, because I feel like, man, we had a president so-called assassinated. Gun violence as an emergency in New York. Incidentally, just about that segment alone, in my view, that is no surprise, whether it's New York specifically or the U.S. in total, with whatever they want to call it, 18 months or so of the so-called pandemic and reports of, you know, epic gun sales this entire time for whatever reason, Black Lives Matter, white genetic annihilation, the Rona, whatever excuse that people had, toilet paper shortages, whatever. All of these new gun owners, it is not surprising at all with the economy. They said stocks took a tumble, as they say. Prices dropped because there were scares. They were saying in California at the Capitol they were going to resume wearing masks. And they were talking about the Delta variant, dreaded Delta variant might cause problems. And, you know, this might mean once it starts to get cold and you can't be outside like Gusty is currently, might have to do some more of those shutdowns. And they might be in isolated areas where people aren't getting vaccinated, like where the niggers live, that type of a thing. Sent stocks down. So in that type of environment, it does not surprise me at all to have shootings or to have more people who are stressed. And summertime, I think they've reported for well over a half century and have lots of statistics and charts. As it gets hotter, you tend to have more violence. And if it really goes up, you might have some riots and, you know, all kinds of collective violence. You've had historic heat waves in the Pacific Northwest, I think now in California and some other regions. So all of that together, it does not surprise me at all. That's just more part of the reason that I've been saying for about a year and a half, like, be very alert when you're out in public. There are lots of folks who are armed. Be very mindful. You don't want to just be running off at the mouth and find out that this person is armed. Yeah, I'm sure there's, you know, crime elements and all of that, people feeling financially insecure and all the rest of it. But I mean, just in general, having lots of new gun owners in a system of white supremacy racism where, as Dr. Welsing said, hey, the great equalizer. Got a problem? Get a gun. Make my day. All the rest of it. That's been the motto, the mantra of white supremacy racism for centuries. So no, it doesn't surprise me at all, and I'll just see more of it continuing, whether it's in a workplace setting or a domestic violence setting, random, this fella, Nathan Allen, whatever it is, I would just expect more of that as the year continues. Let's see, number again, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-#. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Not for spectators. Folks are just hanging out and listening for their Saturday with no thought. Again, we had a presidential assassination and nothing to.
Can I be heard?
Oh, retired firefighter in Florida who was heard two times in the audio clips. Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to everyone. I know you probably talked about Miss Richardson more than once. I just would also add that most of the quote-unquote countries that are going to attend the Tokyo Olympic Games, marijuana is illegal in those places. I don't think they care too much about what the United States policy is on marijuana. And even besides that, the Olympic Committee is a powerful entity when it comes to sports. And if they say that you cannot have marijuana in your system, then and so there will be consequences, then you prepare yourself for that if you intend to participate in the Olympic Games. That would be my advisement for anyone who's interested in that. Then again, all in all, it's not that big of a deal anyway when it comes down to it, on about what someone did in the Olympics. I was just wondering, did anybody report on the Moore gun group, the incident that took place in Massachusetts?
Yes, sir. That was the first report that we aired. We had that from last week where I said last week where you were telling us about it and used the term shootout. And I was saying this week it was not a shootout. It was an armed standoff between the groups.
Right.
But, yeah, we played the segment.
I said shootout.
Two times.
I was wrong.
You did say okay. In the report, we got the full context. You said that you hadn't studied it too hard, that the event had just happened. This was last week, so right after it had just taken place, and you said you were going to look more into it. So,
oh, one thing I did notice, I don't know if anybody else noticed this. They were reportedly with 11 quote-unquote suspects that they brought to court. And I noticed out of the 11, at least three of them would not be racially classified as black males. You know, I don't know if anybody else noticed that, if they saw, because they showed several of them. You know how you come up and you the judge asks on whether or not you are guilty or not guilty of the charges and whatnot, that sort of thing. And also with family members also in the courtroom at the time. And at least two to three of the 11 people would not be racially classified as black males. That's for sure. They seem to look like, a couple of them seem to look like what I would call white males whose primary language is Spanish. Not saying that they speak Spanish, but that's what they looked like, you know, as far as that concern. And I was kind of like surprised by that, if with anything connected with the term called Moor. I'm thinking about a black person. And I was just wondering about that, you know, what's kind of like behind that. Because that's the first time I've seen it. Did anybody make that kind of report on it?
I haven't seen pictures of all 11 of the folks who were arrested, so I didn't get to see the folks that you mentioned who said that they didn't look like people who would be classified as black. I don't know. I mean, right. I can't say it's totally stunning, because, I mean, you've got groups like the Black Panther Party and the On the Move in Pennsylvania, where these were groups that were talking about racism, white supremacy, and how it impacted black people, but they had non-black members too. Sioux Africa, sometimes they even had white members in both organizations, in fact. So it's not totally, you know, surprised. This is the first time that I've heard of this specific organization, so I don't know, you know, all of, you know, about their history and who their members are and, you know, what their ideology is and all of that. But, I mean, it would not be the first time. There are quite a few other organizations that, you know, would appear to be a black thing, if you will, but end up having quite a few folks in it who are not black people.
Yeah. Well, I would say from my probably low understanding of history, when I have always heard the term Moors, that primarily when I saw a picture, whether it was something from hundreds of years ago to present, it looked like a person who would be racially classified as black. That's all. As far as a picture of that person, whether it's a drawing or a photograph, you know, that sort of thing. That's why I was kind of like, what's to that? It reminded me of the, I think it was the Symbionese Liberation Army, which, like you said, would had more than just black people in it. You know, yeah.
I think even the Nation of Islam, we had a white female on the program some years back. She was in the Nation of Islam. So, you know, it's pretty widespread, the confusion of the system. That's why we have this here broadcast. Try to do better, learn better, make better decisions. Incidentally, I will say, even though these folks, the rise of the Moors up in Massachusetts, there was no shootout. This would just, in my opinion, be another illustration. Like, it's almost 2022. White people have shown, in my opinion, conclusively, black people, Negroes with guns, if you will, homage to Robert F. Williams, Negroes with guns pose no threat to white people at all. Like,
right,
zero. Like, you can get as many Negroes as you like to go out and march and organize and whatever else, you know, you want to go out and demonstrate or parade or drill or whatever else, no big deal. It does not, like, intimidate, scare, worry, and in my view, it does not move us, like, one, not an inch is overstating, like, it doesn't move us closer to solving the problem at all. We're talking about master killers. We're talking about the folks who mass produce the guns, not to mention mass killings, but mass produce the guns, mass produce the bullets. In fact, they just had a report. I didn't play because we had so many different audio reports. They had a report talking about how the price of bullets, ammunition has gotten so high that it's causing a problem for police departments. Now, if that's true, and they said that the price of ammunition from this time last year has more than doubled in some areas. Panic. Now, you put that with the report about the gun violence. Just put those two together. They said the price of ammunition has more than doubled in some areas over the last year. And it's gone up so much that it's causing police department. They're having to go, and at the same time that people are saying defund the police and all this, they're having to go and ask for increased budgets because the price of ammunition has gotten so high. All of that to say, it doesn't scare white people. We're talking, it's almost 2022. The lake that I love going to hang out to in Seattle, white people have drones to go out and play at the lake with their floats and dogs and rubber ducky inner tubes and such. I don't need to go out and do a parade with a gun, although they do that as well with their infrared scopes and everything. But I mean, really, it's 2022. They can have one white teenager with a drone, and I think that'll mow down your whole armed, the rise of the Moors or any other armed group of black people. Philando Castile, Micah Xavier Johnson, remember him down in Texas? They used a drone, exactly what I said. They used a drone with explosive device to kill Micah Xavier Johnson, 2016, the year that Donald Trump was elected. So I've seen no evidence. It's VGQ, Victims Guarantee qualified. If you want to get your file, I'm not saying not to do it. I'm just saying I've seen no evidence that it bothers, impairs, causes racist man, racist woman any problems. If anything, a lot of white people in Massachusetts probably got overtime for what happened last weekend. If they had to call out a whole lot of armed white people to ultimately subdue, and that's what happened, to subdue some armed black people, congratulations, fella. This round's on me.
There was one more thing that I noticed about that particular incident that I thought was incorrect. I'm not sure on who to have focus on, but a 17-year-old was apparently one of those 11, a 17-year-old. And I would say if I was a part of that group, I would think it wouldn't be correct to involve a 17-year-old because I don't think a 17-year-old is mature enough to make the type of decisions that where he was found at on that particular scene. It reminds me of Bobby Hutton with the Black Panther Party. He was only 16 years old when he got killed. 16 or 17, one of the two. I'm not 100% sure. When he was influenced by Eldridge Cleaver, Matter of fact, the person who had the means to supply the weapons, he stated, I've seen him on a documentary, stated on his deep regret for getting a gun for Bobby Hutton at the time, because I mean, he understands that from the standpoint of a child can be easily influenced to do certain things, because by nature, that I've noticed as being a football coach for a long time, they young people, they not only look up to the coaches, they also look up to older players, you know, when it comes to, you know, or older, you know, people that's in their group, that sort of thing. And for a 17-year-old, that to me is a little bit too much, you know, as far as having to make the decision to be in that type of life and death situation.
Much obliged.
Hopefully that made some sense.
For sure. Much obliged, retired firefighter. I know that conversation has come up, both Bobby Hutton being 16 years old and ultimately gunned down in response to the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., April 1968. And then even I remember back in 2014 when they had the upheaval in Ferguson after the killing of Michael Brown Jr. It's been 7 years next month. But during one of the nights of protest, they had a really young black girl, and I mean like 5 years old, maybe not even that old, really, really young. And so she's out there doing tear gas and everything. And I was just like, wow. I remember saying, man, you know, if that was my child or a friend, even my neighbor, they're like, man, let's get her inside. Like, you know, it's a little dangerous out here, and I don't really see where anything constructive, you know, can happen. If they have tear gas, children are much more sensitive to toxins and chemicals than adults are. It's nothing good, nothing constructive about this environment. Let's get her inside. And I know some other folks, black people, who said no. You know, war is being waged against black people, and she could die in the house. She could die out here. She could die in the classroom. Like. She should be here to observe all of this and see what happens. Victims guaranteed qualified. I'm not a parent, but I would move my child. Like if it wasn't my child, if it was my cousin, my neighbor, I would move them inside. I just don't see any white people kill lots of black people all the time. White people kill lots of black children. Although we just heard about Joe Green, he easily could have been killed. He was 16 years old. Could have been killed by that race soldier in the store. Over a dollar. Do they even make counterfeit dollars? I don't think that's a good business model to make counterfeit dollars. He's about to die over a dollar. They kill a lot of black children for no reason at all. I would not. If it's, you know, we might die. And even I don't even think you qualify to make that decision. Like, if this is not my child, to decide for you that, yes, at 17 years old, I'm willing to lay down my life. Because, I mean, even to understand that, hey, we're in a system of racism, white supremacy. You don't have to do anything wrong. Us just being black and having these firearms might mean we could be bombed in the next 5 seconds. Like, do you really understand that at 17? And, yep, I'm all right if that happens. Like, do you really understand that at 17? To make that decision.
Right.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. And incidentally, I think Mr. Fuller, he has a whole big chapter in his book, at least the first time around, on war, biggest chapter in the book. Man, he talks extensively about anything that's counter-war or where you might die or something like that. That should be a solo activity. That is not the time for all of the homies to come. Once it's got to that point, I got to pick up a firearm. You should be united, independent. And certainly in my view, this is not the time. Let me go find some teenagers to go in and get at it. Come on. Come on. Come on.
Right. Right.
Let's see. Yep. Other folks just trying to follow logic. I could be in error, and again, I am not an attempted parent. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up.
Hello?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. Hope everyone's having the best evening you can have. Those are really good clips. I guess I wanted to talk a little bit about the gun issue. Recently here where I live, they had a sting operation. I guess that's what you would call it. Over about a month and a half, where they took, they said they were the illegal guns off the street. So, they say off the street, like they were on the ground, but off the streets. And they showed pictures of most of the people involved. Everyone appeared to, from the picture I saw, they were small. They did appear to be people who would be classified as Black. The neighborhoods, as they identified, I believe. Well, I mean, this area, Black people live everywhere. But I believe those are higher concentrations of what people may say are lower income Black people. So no, they're not scared. They know where you are. And in terms of, I guess, young people with guns, I don't necessarily think that's a good idea either, but I don't know, the white people seem to think it's okay to do it with their kids. So if you are going to have a young person with a gun, yes, make sure they know what to do and the importance of what they have and that it really, is a weapon. And then even with the covering of this, they said, oh, these awful guns on the street. And the person, I guess the police person, they're holding up a rifle, but when they show the pictures of the actual guns, I mean, some of them were like colored. You would think it was a toy gun because it was a different color. They were little. They all looked like little pistols. And not to say, that's right to have a legal gun if it's a pistol. But when it's people are classified as Black, they make everything sound worse. So, they captured all these people with these illegal guns. I guess the crime rate is high for this area. I come from a larger city, so in fact, the city that has the governor of Andrew Cuomo, that's where I grew up. So. I do feel about the gun violence, but I guess living here in this area, it's a big issue in general, but I guess it doesn't affect my day-to-day life as in some of those other areas. And I do hope those other areas, they get the proper help because, like I said, for us, they'll just take them away. They have the gun buyback programs, but for young white people, they're just going hunting. And then next thing you know, everyone in the school is dead. Thank you.
Much obliged, caller in Georgia. That's interesting. I guess that's what they call them, sting operations, right? That's what they call them. I don't know I'd have to think, like, what's a arrest? Mate, it's more. It's not just. That's like an arrest. Singular. That's what they call them. A sting op. Like a arrest. See like a program, some sort of campaign, probably prearranged where they're going to arrest large numbers of people, like not a singular person, generally speaking. But so they're having this sting for this gun operation so they can show lots of Black people, like, I don't know. Like, when I think of a gun problem in the U.S., I generally think of individuals classified as white. But all right, we can show more Black criminality and thuggery in the midst of 2021. Absolutely correct. White people do go out and train very young children, very young, like, oof, eight, nine, whatever you can think of. Absolutely. They do it all the time. And it seems almost sometimes brag about passing on guns as heirlooms to their female or male offspring, and or taking them out to train and all this and all of that. And it's not stigmatized as some sort of criminal act. Maybe it should be. Nathan Allen and all the rest, maybe it should be. But you're absolutely correct. That's not the way it's typically thought of in the system of white supremacy. I can't say that the gun violence is impacting me like personal. What? I take that back. This has been the worst year ever. I have to take that back. There was the shooting right across from my residence this year. I told you I didn't even know about it until days afterwards where I was informed, and I thought it was firecrackers or something, you know, silly, not a shooting from earlier. So yes, it has personally impacted me. I'd have to double check to see the numbers for gun violence in Seattle specifically, but I know Washington State is what they call gun country. Lots of gun owners here and concealed carry. I think this is an open carry state, Washington State, I believe. So yeah, I'd have to double check to see how all of that is going. But man, I can only say I am not surprised, given all the stress that people have been living with for the past 18 months, the uncertainty ongoing, and then the huge number of new gun owners. I can easily see how that would create an environment where you would have shootings, even suicides, all of the above. All of the above. Very dangerous times, especially here, U.S. Number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Last few moments, less folks are have something else. No spectating. If you have comments, questions, you want to make sure you share, go ahead and chime or raise a hand, share a thought. I guess, I don't know if people just not paying attention to the assassination or still taking time to process. Maybe don't keep up with Haitian news on a regular basis. They don't really have a context for it. Something to be mindful about. Maybe read a bit on over the next few days, weeks or so. I think that is important as well. Like, investigate that. Was it reported that DEA agents, Drug Enforcement Agency officials, may have been present and or involved in the assassination of Jovenel Moise? Like, wow, that would be something to do some more reading, do some investigating, see what you find in different, you know, reports about that. Like, wow. Very interesting. Anytime, same thing.
You still there, Gus?
We can hear you.
Oh, okay. Gus probably got cut off in some kind of way, because I was going to give a short report on the. Okay, can you hear me, Gus?
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. She was brought. The wife was brought here to probably one of the most experienced trauma centers in the world. It's called Ryder Trauma Center. It's connected with the hospital that's called Jackson Memorial Hospital in Miami, and which was the right place to have her to come, because they certainly get a lot of practice on gunshot wounds. With me being a retired firefighter, I'm quite aware with the workings that goes on at Ryder Trauma Center. If you haven't been around it, it would actually surprise you on how much people can bleed and suffer. But also, one thing I noticed is that a number of the people that was quote unquote captured were from Colombia, from what I understand, and it takes on that type of person that
is common to South Florida. I think the only two quote unquote Haitians that was captured were actually from South Florida. They showed both of them. But it's still, the story is still coming out down here, as far as details, details of what took place, the grounds on which the president and his wife were at. They just filled it with a whole lot of people who had intent to assassinate or kill this person. And I mean, it was like, I saw at least about maybe four or five vehicles with people on them, you know, pickup trucks and whatnot, that sort of thing. So it was going to be very difficult for him to survive from such a onslaught. I'll put it that way. But from my understanding, the wife is in a reasonable, good condition for right now. In Miami, Florida.
Much obliged, retired firefighter in Florida. I saw that. I thought that was interesting as well. Some of the folks that they, even the language they used in the report that we played, or one of the reports, they said they paraded suspects in front of the press. Like, that's interesting language. Like, I thought they said they just had a parade in New York for the essential workers, and now you are parading these suspects out to us. But they said that some of the folks in custody, some of them apparently were U.S. citizens, Haitian nationals, as they say, maybe born in Haiti, but they've migrated here, been naturalized U.S. citizens. Some of them also, they said, were so-called right. Colombians, born in Colombia, which, you know, that's, but then, like I said, the BBC, so the report, second report that we played about the assassination, and in the New York Times, they say they have multiple videos where, I'm just reading what it says, this is New York Times, and videos filmed from nearby buildings and synchronized by the New York Times, the group of commandos who appear to be arriving to assassinate President Jovenel Moise shouted that they were part of a U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency operation. Now again, usual suspects. If this is the case, I wouldn't be stunned. I mean, hey, the United States military ran the area of the world known as Haiti for a number of years. So this wouldn't even technically be meddling in foreign affairs. I mean, it's Haiti. Right. They're niggers, basically. So, you right. know.
From 1915 to the 1930s, they ran with the United States Marine Corps. They ran Haiti. United States did. Yes.
Lots to be mindful about. Again, global system of white supremacy, racism. They do lots. Stockton, California, and Georgia, and Ahmaud Arbery, and Nathan Allen up in Massachusetts, and Cancer Alley down in Louisiana. Like, yes, 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 yes. All white supremacy, racism. Entire planet as a plantation. That's what we have. Man, paying attention to what and the historical context as well. Like, wow, but that is something to be mindful about, that the New York Times and the BBC both sharing information, allegations that the DEA was involved in this assassination. I was going to say stunning, but maybe it shouldn't be. Any final comments folks need to get in before we conclude? We'll assume folks are satisfied for the broadcast. Didn't miss anyone. didn't think so. We should be, like I said, check Black Talk Radio Network Facebook page for programs before the book club this coming Thursday. Incidentally, I'll say before we wrap up, we had Brian S. Bentley on the program this Monday, black male, former LAPD officer. And he was talking about, he said that he thought OJ was innocent during the trial. And then after he worked security at OJ's house and met him, he changed his mind and said, oh, yeah, I think he did it. And I said, well, what specifically? And he said, well, he had big hands and he seemed to just be really enthralled about going out and talking to people like all day long, just loved all the attention and people coming by and wanting to get his autograph and all the rest of it. Like, just, you know, he just needed it. Seemed like he just had an addiction for all that attention. And he said the timeline was incorrect, that people heard the dogs barking earlier than 10:15, early 10 p.m. on the night of the murders, 1994. And I said, wow, it's fascinating, because for most of my life, I thought O.J. Simpson was guilty. To have an LAPD officer say that, and I'm just sitting and listening like, wow, that's nothing to the evidence about Mr. Simpson being guilty. I think most of us knew he had large hands. What are they? Doesn't fit. Must have quit. Yes, he has large hands. That doesn't exactly mean that you killed anyone. And most importantly, Mr. Bentley, he said, fellow officers were upset because they felt there should not have been charges brought at all because they didn't have enough evidence to charge Orenthal James. I thought that was super important because that is also a conclusion that I came to, that I don't think you have enough evidence for a case here. And they ended up not getting a conviction. And he said in the midst of all that, he said, hey, sometimes guilty people get framed. And I just, I thought about that all week. Like, man, if it's presumption of innocence, I think that's what they say. Presumption of innocence, Constitution at all. If it's presumption of innocence and there doesn't seem to be enough evidence for a case, why would we be thinking that we framed a guilty person? Why wouldn't it just be, hey, this fella's innocent. We don't have enough evidence. He didn't do it, or if he did do it, tips off to you because we don't even have evidence to charge you. So until that changes, innocent. No, no, no. We just tried to frame a guilty man and didn't have enough evidence. So tried to frame a guilty man and couldn't even do that appropriately. Like, whew. My bad, Orenthal James. I'm sorry. I thought you were guilty all these years. I'm sorry. Racist man, racist woman, racist child. They are master deceivers. They can fool you on all kinds of things. Diet, super important. We can end on that one. Drink more water. Get some exercise. I went swimming today. This has been a terrible year, beginning to end. That shootings and everything. It's just been awful. But went swimming today. Felt great. Get some exercise. Eat well. Those fruits, vegetables. Drink your water. That right there, taking best care of yourself you possibly can, watching what you eat, that right there works against racism, white supremacy. We do not want white medications and their toxins, and we do not want our bodies in such disrepair that racist doctors get their meat hooks and claws and all the rest so they can do a Henrietta Lacks metaphor deliberately. Do a job, a racist job on us. All of that said, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Whew. Sha'Carri Richardson. Sobriety would be best. In addition to being sober, they said the price of ammunition is more than double what it was last year. Gun violence as an emergency in New York. When you are out and about, you should be thinking like, woo, this person that's over here and being hostile and rowdy might be armed. In fact, might have a whole entourage of armed thugs ready to do some killing and shooting. If you didn't leave your residence, prepare to kill and or die. Exit. You should be thinking what they call it, long, hot summer. That's what we might have. I'm not getting into any sort of conflicts with strangers out in public. tell people in your so-called family and care mates and all the rest as well. When you're out and about, you are alert. You're driving. You are not on the cell phone, driver or passenger. You are buckled. You are mindful about what is happening around you and doing the small things that you can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no, sober, buckled, hands at 10 and 2, as they say. All of that said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cows signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.